It's time to get started. We'd like to welcome you out to the Southern Region RAC. My name is Dave Black. I'm the chairman from St. George. Represent public at large. We appreciate your attendance. Thank you for coming this evening. Looks like we have a good crowd. Also, before we start, I'd like to recognize two of our Wildlife Board members that we have with us. We have Donnie Hunter, Steve Dalton. Thank you for being here. And then also, before I let the RAC introduce themselves, I'd like to welcome back Nick Georgeson. He's been on sabbatical for a year, served a mission in Vermont, and it's good to have him back. Thanks for coming back. Let's start down on my left, down there, Brian, and if you guys want to introduce yourselves.
Brian, this is going to be a good night. I don't even have to grab the microphone. Brian Johnson from Enoch, Utah, representing the non-consumptives.
Braden Richmond from Beaver, representing sportsmen.
Riley Roberts, sportsman.
Wade Heaton, at large.
I'm Teresa Griffin, sitting in for Kevin Bennell, who is gone. I'm the wildlife manager for the Southern Region.
Nick Jorgensen from St. George, representing the non-consumptive.
Greg Lobb from Iron County, representing agriculture.
Roland King from Bicknell, agriculture.
Tammy Pearson, Beaver County Commissioner.
Gene Boardman, Hinckley, representing the public at large.
Mike Worthen, Cedar City, representing the public at large.
Okay, thank you. In the back, we had a handout that talked about the RAC process and the procedures. I just want to go over that real quick. I'm sure most of you have been to a RAC meeting before. As we go through the meeting today, as we get to an agenda action item, we'll have one of the DWR employees make a presentation for us. And then afterwards, there'll be a minute to ask for any clarifications or questions. And that will come from the RAC members and also from the public, from the audience. Just remember, at this time, this is not the comment portion. It's only a question or a clarification. If anybody comes up to the mic, we ask that you use this mic over here on your left. We'd like to keep all conversations that we have in the room over a microphone. We want to make sure they're all recorded. If you come to the mic, please state your name so that gets on the minutes as well. And so we'd ask that we keep all of our conversations at a mic. Following that, we'll have a comment portion. If you want to make a comment, please fill out the comment cards. We'll allow 3 minutes for individuals and up to 5 minutes per group. And so again, if you're here to make a comment, please make sure you fill out a comment card. Give those to one of the DWR employees and they'll bring them up for us. The next agenda item is to approve the agenda in the minutes. So if you guys are ready for that, I'll entertain a motion. Okay, so we have a motion from Craig Lobb to approve the agenda in the minutes. Do we have a second?
I got a question.
Okay.
Where do you find the minutes?
Those should have been emailed after the last.
Never got anything.
Okay, we'll make sure that we follow up on that. Really? Okay. Well.
And the only thing online was the audio.
Okay. If there's an issue after this one, let me know. Let's make sure we get a chance to look at those before our next rack. So we'll follow up on that. Thank you. Do I have a second? Okay, I have a second from Riley. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. Okay, so item number three will be a wildlife board meeting update. That's myself. If you recall, the last meeting that we had was pretty big agenda. I think we were here, well, he's in Beaver, but we were there till about midnight. There's a couple of things out of that that I just wanted to go over. The first one was on the coyote bounty program amendments. I know that Mike had a concern with the funding of that program, and that during the course of the year, if that funding was to be diminished, his concern was is that they wanted the full bounty paid out. Is that right, Mike? And we requested that there be an action log item. As soon as we brought that up to the board, it didn't take very long to realize that the DWR is very committed to that program to make sure that the full bounty is there. A number of the sportsmen's groups stepped up. They're very concerned as well and made a commitment to make sure that program is funded and that the full bounty would be available throughout the year. So I think we got a pretty strong commitment there. The big item was the Mineral Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. There was a lot of discussion, a lot of comments, similar to those that we have here. At the end, that plan passed as presented, 5 in favor and 1 opposed. Everything else pretty much went through and passed as presented on the other action items, but those were the two main ones that I wanted to report back on. We have a regional update from Teresa.
All right, we don't have too much. We do have a lot of fires. So far in the region, we've had the West Valley Fire on the Pine Valley unit, the Cove Creek just west of here on the Beaver unit, Sand Ledges on the Monroe, Wood Canyon on the Oak Creek, and we have been involved in the process to do rehab for all of them. And then one real positive thing, they've got a horse gather that is planned to occur on the Southwest Desert, and that does include our Indian Peaks Wildlife Management Area. About the only other thing that I wanted to update you on, today there was a press release, and I'll just read parts of it. A biologist on July 20th for Zion National Park saw a desert bighorn sheep that was coughing. That was euthanized, and it was tested, and it did test positive for Mycoplasma ovipneumonia, which is the bacteria associated with pneumonia in bighorn sheep. Since then, they've euthanized another sheep, and it's been taken up to another lab to be tested. We're working closely with them, and we're ramping up surveys outside the park to see what other sheep in the unit have been impacted. So, you know, if you guys are out and about looking at sheep and you do see some that are coughing, you know, let us know. It's going to be a hard one to contain, especially with the national park involved. So it's not the news we want to hear, but it is occurring. None have been documented that we have seen die yet, but they're just showing they're symptomatic currently. That's about it.
Okay.
Did you test any of the sheep that you just transplanted from there?
Yes, before we try to test different units every year. last year, before we did the transplant that went to the North San Juan, I think we caught 25 inside the park where we caught those sheep, and all of those were negative. So we've never had a positive on that unit before, and we've done several rounds of testing both inside the park and outside the park. So they've never thrown a positive before. They've always been negative.
What's your theory on where it came from then?
Yeah, well, it's strange because it's isolated right now inside the park in between the two tunnels. You know, of course, that's where the majority of the people are seeing them. Today, we were kind of on the east end of the park, and we saw a bunch of sheep. None of them were showing any signs of being sick. You know, we've had some rogue goats that have been seen over by Hilldale. I don't know if there's any backyard stuff in Springdale. We're not really sure what's going on. So we're just ramping up surveys.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Mike?
Yeah, you answered the question where it came from, but I'm wondering, too, have you done any research or any studies on what, because this population has not been allowed to be trapped or removed any sheep for a number of years until just recently. Is it kind of like prairie dogs when they get too many, the disease kicks in and there's really nothing you can do about it?
I think that the densities make it worse because then you've got sheep expanding and roaming and looking for new territories. That's why we've tried to be aggressive since the population has grown big. What year did we start?
2013.
So 2013 was the first time that we moved sheep outside of the unit, and we've tried to keep thinning it out the best we can. But they still, you know, whether they wander and then have an exposure and come back to the herd, or if, you know, there's a rogue goat or something that, we're not really sure, but the density does push them to find some new territories, and that makes it worse, but they do still have to go out and have contact with that pathogen somewhere.
Has there been studies on just stress-related, you know, where you have the density, but you also have stress-induced? Because any other animal would do that.
Yeah, and I'm not certain with bighorn sheep. I mean, sometimes you'll get epizootic hemorrhagic disease, or, I mean, they occasionally will have contagious eczema, or, you know, some different things, but I don't know that this one isn't strictly density dependent. So I'm not completely certain of.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to our first action item, which is item number 5 in the agenda. This is the or 657-11 fur bearer rule amendments. What's that? Oh, I skipped over that. I'm sorry. Sorry, my mic was sitting on top of it. Yeah, sorry about that. Let's do that. That's item. Where is it?
It's not on there, but we will.
Oh, that's why I missed it. Please. No, we want to do the informational items first. Oh, I see, down at the bottom. Okay. Southern region.
You want me over there still or here?
It's up to you. If you want this whole slide.
Okay. My name is Gary Bezen. I'm the Habitat Program Manager for the Southern region. It's been a few years since we've done some of these, but you'll see us do one or two a year for the next coming years. All of our wildlife management areas are supposed to have a management plan, and they all do, and we're at the point now where it's time to revise them and update them because they've been around for a while. And so the first one we worked on, and it's kind of based on a purchase that we made back in 2013, and a need to address some of the stuff associated with that purchase, is the Fillmore Wildlife Management Area. So for background, you see there on the slide the Habitat Management Plan review process. There's a specific codified process we have to follow to update those plans, and certain groups that we have to take that to. And the RAC is one of those. It's, and you'll notice it doesn't even say optional. You guys are required to hear this, so I'm glad I get to be here, and you guys get to hear from me. And then again, further in that code, it specifies what specifically needs to be in those plans. A lot of it is, why do we own the property? What is the purpose we have there? And how are we going to manage that moving forward to accomplish those purposes? So specifically, let's jump right into the Fillmore Wildlife Management Area. This is a great, one of our best wildlife management area units. We've got a lot of property up there. It's, we could call it the Millard County Wildlife Management Area as well. It goes kind of from Scipio Pass all the way down south to Kanawha and takes in a lot of country. You can jump into there. We've got this map that kind of shows you what I was just highlighting, starting up there at Scipio Pass, running all the way down through there. What I think is amazing is that with the history of this plan and the history of these properties, that there were people that had the foresight clear back in the 1950s to recognize we've got all that Forest Service property up there on the mountain, and then down in the bottom there was a need to preserve mule deer winter range to protect and preserve those herds, and that there was foresight out there to get enough properties out there that we can do that. So the WMA takes in 16,812 acres. Like I mentioned, it's purpose is specifically for critical winter habitat for big game, initially for mule deer, but since then with the elk coming on, the elk use it really hard too, and they're a great, it's a great piece of property. These properties were purchased with the Pittman-Robertson funds, except for the last piece that we picked up. It was secured in a land trade with the School and Institutional Trust Land Administration as part of the Lee Kay exchange that was done back in 2013. And so you can see there, going back to 1939 even, was when people started thinking about this and making sure that we were thinking about the winter range and securing that for the mule deer. There's a lot of hunting that happens on this wildlife management area, a lot of mule deer hunting, a lot of elk hunting, and in the recent years, turkey hunting has become very popular there as well. And we get a little bit of grouse and dove hunting as well. And just kind of a view from the up high, looking out across some of the properties. With that much property, we have a lot of diversity out there. We have old fires that we can look at. We have habitat treatments we've been doing over the years, so there's a lot of diversity in the property. Part of the plan is to identify how this does benefit wildlife. The purpose is for mule deer winter range, but there's other wildlife that benefit. One of the big reasons that it's become really important is that I-15 corridor severely diminishes the access to winter range, and so having these properties there on the east side of I-15 has helped that a whole bunch. In addition, like I mentioned, we've got wild turkey, we've got cottontails, we've got morning dove, rough grouse. I hear you guys are going to talk about cougars a little later tonight. That should be exciting. Bobcats, raptors, and we've also identified 9 state-sensitive species there. And then we've got a couple of small creeks that run through a couple of the units, and so we have some brown trout, rainbow trout, cutthroat, and cutthroat rainbow hybrids as well. The good news is a lot of the condition on the WMA is in really good condition. Our biggest concern up there is for some invasive plants. Cheatgrass, like a lot of our areas on winter range, is a big concern, but we see a lot of good success as we do habitat treatment, so we're able to get other good species in there. And then unique to the Fillmore WMA is bulbous bluegrass, which is it's a native grass, but it's very invasive and spreads through almost through disturbance. It's a tuber, and the bulbs spread, and it goes crazy, and it's taking over a lot of country up there, and it's challenging to work with and find ways to replace that with more valuable grass. And then, again, common to mule deer winter range across the state, pinyon and juniper encroachment is a big deal, but we've been very active up on the Fillmore WMA, and we do all we can to work on that. Another picture there, you can kind of see the condition of some of that pinyon juniper encroachment, but we've got a lot of great browse species. We've got a lot of cliff rose up there, actually, which the mule deer absolutely love, and it's a great winter range plant for them as well. One of the things that did happen with that 2013 acquisition from the SITLA, we had a road that they had that was very well improved up to our property boundary. Let me just jump to the map and show you. You can see the two pieces, the Pioneer unit and the original Circus Hollow unit, were pieces that we owned, and then the 2013 addition had a road that was very a great road all the way through the SITLA section, and then it dead end. It didn't dead end, but it hit our piece of property, and it turned into a terrible road. But people really wanted that road to connect to the Pioneer unit and the really good Pioneer road up there. And so we had to make some decisions. It was a road that was previously classified as seasonally closed. When we picked up that piece in 2013, the county had been maintaining it and so forth, and there was a strong interest locally to have that become a year-round road, and it would look really silly to put up a closed seasonally with this beautiful road behind it that's in really good condition. So we have worked with the county. This is the section that crossed our property, and so you can see the condition. People really wanted to use it in the winter. And we talked with Dave Smedley, with our local law enforcement guys, and we've had a lot of issues with the ability to enforce a seasonal closure up there anyway. And so what we proposed is to reroute the road, make it a little shorter, get them back to the main roads quicker. And what you can't see in that is it creates a loop that people love to drive. And without the loop, they're having to backtrack miles and miles both directions to then hit the front end road, go up, and then hit the other road. And so in reality, providing this loop, we're reducing miles traveled through winter range. And so that was the decision we did make in the plan, was to go ahead and open that year-round as opposed to keeping it closed seasonally. A lot of recreational opportunities on the WMA. It's an exciting one, that it's one that a lot of hunting does happen on it, and it can be both the winter range, and but the deer move into there early enough that they're able to be hunted there as well, and so it's a lot of fun. Year-long wildlife viewing opportunities. You can go see elk on the winter range. It's a great place to go. Camping is allowed. It's not something we promote. We don't have any improved campgrounds or anything, but it's something that is permissible to do up there. And then right there behind the town of Fillmore, there's a community gun range that we have managed cooperatively with Millard County for a number of years and continue to do that, and it's a great resource for the community there. I mentioned earlier habitat improvement activities. We have been very active doing habitat improvement projects, bull hogs, chainings, fire rehabilitation when fires hit those, and we keep moving forward on that. So I think moving forward into the future, a lot of it will be monitoring and maintaining those and making sure that they maintain the value that they have. This, again, just a picture of an example of a habitat treatment that we did, a lop and scatter on the Kanosh unit. You can see the way that the habitat responds when you remove the pinyon juniper encroachment and make the water available to the sagebrush and other browse species there. This is a chaining we did up on the Youngsfield unit. Again, same type of thing. A great thing. We're able to improve forage significantly and improve the browse for the wintering deer and elk on the unit. We also have grazing that we use quite intensively up there with that much property, and it's kind of a cool thing. We've improved a lot of our properties with grazing, managing it at the right time. That's some of the ways we can confront those challenges of cheatgrass and the bulbous bluegrass. They come on a little earlier than a lot of the other grasses, so we get on there early. They can hit those early and then enable the other species to do well. And then the other thing that we've done with the Fillmore WMA units is we make sure they're all available as a grass bank. So this isn't all of our units. We have about 10 units. We're only actively grazing about 5 of them. We have elk and deer use that's high enough on the other units to warrant to keep it in the condition we're looking for anyway. But you'll see, if you look at the Circus Hollow unit, going from 2017, we had 45 AUMs on there, to zero in 2018. That was a unit where we did a wildlife project on a piece of private property, and one of the arrangements we made, we were able to provide a spot for them to go for the 2 years while their property was maturing and the seeding that we did, and we protected our investment, and now we're able to move them back onto their property, and it worked out as a good thing. We've also done, in recent years, with fires that have affected producers, we're able to move them onto the WMAs back again in the fall. Several of our guys that go on in the spring have come back on in the fall because the Forest Service has had to move them off because of fires. And with having as much property as we have up there, it's been a good resource for the state of Utah to provide that benefit to some of those grazers temporarily and not create a harm to the wildlife either. Moving forward, the property management needs, annually we go out and we maintain all the fences, maintain all the signage. Where we do have degrazing, those grazers participate in the fence maintenance with us as well. When this is plan is approved, we'll need to continue to work with Millard County to do that rerouting of that road that I mentioned. And then Kendall Bagley, our biologist up there, the habitat biologist, is always working on it, improving water systems and making water widely available on all the units and it's distributing the use across them. With that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Vern?
That grazing is cattle or sheep? Or?
That's all cattle.
Okay.
Looking at this, this is quite a scattered WMA. Is it in that way different from all the other WMAs in the
Yeah, this plan was a little harder to write than some in that we have the 10 separate units, and so in some ways it's like there's 10 little plans within one big plan, and so the plans I bring to you in the future, this one's, you know, 60 plus pages, hopefully will be 20 to 25 pages for the other units. But we do have, you know, the Beaver Complex, there's, you know, five or six properties on the Parowan front. It's broken up into four or five properties, but this is the biggest complex we have of them like that.
So it's hard for sportsmen to know whether they're on a WMA or not. So are your rules for the WMA basically what the rules for public land is?
Yes, they are. Yeah. And they're signed very well. Our crew does a really good job. So if you do go drive along the Fillmore Winter Range, I would hope that you really would know when you're on a WMA.
Okay. Tammy?
We're just all kinds of full of questions. So are these all fenced, individually fenced?
The majority of them are. There are a couple of small parcels that are addressed in the plan. We call them disposal pieces. They're right along the I-15 corridor. They're 5 to 10 acres, and so we don't really highlight them. They're pieces that were picked up with the large parcels. They're not fenced, and at some point in the future, we would likely dispose of those.
Okay, so my next question is, as far as grazing, who are your neighbors? Is it BLM or Forest Service?
Uphill, we have Forest Service, and downhill, it's mostly private property.
So are the grazers, do you coordinate with Forest Service or BLM?
We coordinate with the Forest Service quite a bit. Most of our dates, we start them as early as we can, and their off date is coordinated with their uphill permit. Most of our permittees have the uphill permit from the property moving on to the forest right from us.
So it's kind of a transition area?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Procedurally, if you guys have any comments or things you'd like me to address, I guess you just do that by email if any of you have seen that. And if you have any editing comments, even if I didn't put a period in the right place, I'm happy to move it. So. Let me know.
Thank you. Okay, now we're ready for item number 5.
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. And hopefully, yeah, okay. This is like the bane of my existence. You know. All right, we'll do that. We've got three things tonight. I'm used to hitting my head on things, too. But I wanted to start off tonight with some recommendations for changes to our fur bearer rule. Is it? So it's got a short, too. That's good. Anyway, moving right along, we have a few. I can talk loud, but then they can't. What do you think? Oh, there we go. Improvised. I know, exactly. So this is better.
remember last time Jayla was witness? And they'd ask me a question after Jayla would answer, and then I'd come on. Are we going to get feedback from that? All right. Okay, now I totally lost my... No, you're fine. No, it's good. So, fur bearer rule. As many of you may remember, we talked quite a bit about this last year. We had some proposed changes to the rule. And the concern we had at the time is that we wanted to make sure that if people were setting coyote or raccoon sets in the field and they caught something they didn't intend to catch, there'd be an opportunity for them to release that protected wildlife unharmed. And so we made some suggested changes. One of the oversights during that process, which I'm sure you all remember, is that we really didn't have a good representation during that process from private landowners, agricultural community. And that became very clear through the RAC process as well as the board. And so the board made passed most of the suggested changes, but they directed us to put a committee together to address those specific concerns. And we did that within about a month of the board meeting last year. We put a committee together to try to address some of the concerns that producers specifically had with those rule changes last year around. Here's a list of groups that were invited to attend that committee. Specific, you know, we want to make sure wool growers were there. The commissioner of the Department of Agriculture and Food was part of that committee. And so we try to get a good cross section and make sure we could have a good discussion and see if we could find some solutions. The committee agreed on a few objectives, some things that we wanted to get out of the process and make sure that the rule addressed, and these are them. First of all, we wanted to make sure we address the concerns livestock producers might have with the rule and how that pertained to specifically coyotes, but raccoons to some extent as well. The second thing we wanted to make sure that we did in the rule is to allow live release of protected species caught in coyote and raccoon traps. The third is to encourage public support of trapping. We took a little bit of time. There's actually a study that was done in 2016 in Connecticut, Illinois, and Wisconsin, so kind of the East Coast states, that showed that support for trapping is high in those states. And that translates here, too, in the West. And one thing that came out of that study is that the general public is supporting of the practice if they feel like it's well-regulated, that non-target species can be released if they're accidentally caught. There are a few factors like that. So we want to make sure that we maintain high public support for trapping through the process and through the rule. And finally, we wanted to make sure we provide legal protection for trappers who accidentally catch protected wildlife in those sets. And so we wanted to hold people harmless that were playing by the rules, but accidentally catch something they didn't intend to catch and not be cited in those instances. So we had a really good discussion, went through quite a few issues, but the longer we were there, it became apparent there really was one primary thing that if we could fix it, people at the meeting felt like it would address their concerns. And that is in this recommendation here. So what we're proposing, to make compliance with the rule easier, allow the owner of a trap to designate another person to check or remove wildlife from their traps, provided these things. The traps appropriately marked with the owner's trap registration number. The person has required licenses when working with fur bearer sets. So if they're trying to catch something besides coyote and raccoons, they have to have all the proper permits to do that. The person does not have a denied or suspended trap registration license. This is just so that somebody who's on suspension can't go trap for someone else and kind of get around that suspension. And finally, that the owner assumes this sounds harsher than it is, but let me tell you what the intent is. But this is what the rule says. Owner assumes criminal liability and civil responsibility for the designated person And what we're trying to do there is make sure if you're authorizing someone to go check your traps, that they're aware of what the rules are, and there's some liability on you to make sure that they understand that when they're doing that activity. So that was the main thing that came out of that committee. When we finished the meeting, all the groups went back, talked to their various constituencies, and we did some follow-up through email and phone calls just to make sure everybody was still okay with that, and everybody was. So a couple other changes we're proposing. First of all, we wanted to clarify in the rule that coyotes and raccoons are regulated by the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. They're not regulated by the Division of Wildlife Resources, and so they are non-protected species, and the division is not trying to exert any kind of authority of management for those two species. And then the second thing here is just anytime we refer in the rule to coyote or raccoon traps, we're just referring to the type of set. Again, just trying to identify a traps type, not trying to assert any kind of authority over management for those species. That was important to Ag. They wanted to make sure that was clear in our rule, that they had management authority, not the division. These changes we're recommending didn't come directly from that committee. The first one here is something that our legal team wanted to clarify in the rule that was not clear. It just clarifies who may legally euthanize a bobcat caught in a trapping device. The bottom line here is that if you're in the field trapping bobcats, the person that shoots the bobcat has to put their tag on it. You can't shoot it and then put someone else's tag on the cat. And then finally, this was a little bit of an oversight in the rule, but the way the rule read before, it authorized two or three different types of people to disturb or remove traps from the field. And included in that list was owners of domestic pets. That was not the intent. I mean, essentially what the rule allowed the person to do is if they saw a trap in the field and they were walking their dog, they could take it. That's not the intent of the rule. So if your animal, your pet gets caught in a trap, you are authorized through the rule to disturb the trap in order to remove your pet, but you can't take that person's trap and take it home or break it or throw it in the weeds or something like that. And that's it.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have questions from the rack? Mike?
First off, I appreciate the division backing up on this and taking another look at it, but I still have a few concerns. In that paragraph you put together saying that the coyotes and raccoons are the responsibility, the management of them are the responsibilities of the Department of Ag. I still see in there that the division is regulating the devices by which they're taken with. And that concerns me because the legislature was very clear on who had management authority of coyotes and raccoons. And I don't think even the secretary of the division or the Department of Agriculture can give that or sign that over to the DNR because without legislative blessing, because the legislature gave it to them.
Right.
And so when I see in that paragraph mentioned that use of the regulation concerning coyotes and raccoons are intended to solely to minimize take of non-target protected wildlife, that's still the division putting management responsibilities on coyotes and raccoons. That's the departments of Ags, and it's not too much of a problem for me other than if somebody gets pinched, you know darn well they're going to look at that and say, hey, I'm going to beat this thing because The division has no means of saying that I'm not doing what I can do.
Right.
And I guess where I'm coming from is if you're trying to do what you say and make it so that it's non-target, more non-target friendly, or able to remove protected species from them, give us a division and help them write a rule to be passed. And to, up to now, that hasn't been done. And right. So we've got a lot of going back and forth, who has what, who can do what, and claiming responsibility. So that's my suggestion to do that. The other thing that division is let me see if I can find that real quick. The 600 feet within a building, from a building or a resident or whatever, you can trap, but you get outside of that, and they're what for coyotes and raccoons? Can they trap any time, or just when there's a problem with livestock confrontations or with predators? Livestock?
They can trap any time. What the rule does is says it. Basically says if you're going to put a trap in the field that has a potential of catching a species we regulate, we require you to have identify the trap with a trap registration number, and it has to be checked if it's a live set every 48 hours, if it's a snare, a lethal set, every 96.
And then what would it be if it was a coyote and raccoon? They were
same thing. If you put a trap out that could catch a protected species, even if you're intending to catch coyotes, about a quarter of the time with a coyote set, you'll catch something else that you didn't intend to catch. And since we have management authority over those animals, and since we want trapping to, we want people to feel like that people are able to release non-target species, and we want people to release non-target species, we just need to keep track of whose traps those are and be able to identify that through a number.
And I can understand that, but still again, to me, it appears that you're tromping on the UDAF's authority by managing coyotes' take, telling them you can't go trap coyotes over here unless you have a license or whatever, and the UDA doesn't require a license to trap coyotes. So my suggestion is to take it back to and work with UDA on developing some rules that make sense to make this thing work, because I see a no-win situation for the division if somebody gets pinched doing this, and that's my major concern.
Okay. Okay. Any questions, Brian?
I got time. Sorry. Okay. So if I put a trap out and all I ever catch is a coyote, it doesn't matter. I'm totally, and just wondering if I'm not. I think this is what Mike's saying. I can put a trap out, catch a non-target, non-regulated species, and you guys can't touch me if I don't put a trap, if I don't put a tag on it. But the second a targeted species goes into it, I'm in trouble because I just poached a targeted species.
The problem we had, and I don't know if there's anyone here from law enforcement tonight that might be able to speak to this. The problem is we had people that were trying to catch other things. They didn't have their traps marked. They're trapping over bait. They weren't following the rules at all. And then when an officer would find that trap, they'd say, well, I'm just trapping coyotes. And they had a get out of jail free card on that. And that, so that's part of the concern.
So I'm good with that. And I say the second that a targeted species, protected species steps in that trap, we throw the book at them. I'm with you, Mike. If you're trapping coyotes, let them trap coyotes.
Right.
They get to be big boys too about it.
Right.
So if they're going to be big boys and say, hey, I'm trapping coyotes, the second you trap something you're not supposed to, you get the book thrown at you.
Right.
So I think that's what you're, is that kind of what you're getting at? Is let's
work with right. The division of ag to shore that up.
Right. What the rule does right now, Brian, is if you're trapping coyotes and you've got a number on your trap and you're coming around and checking it and you catch a bobcat or a badger or whatever and it dies, the rule says we're not going to charge you with anything as long as you're.
And that's a great right. rule, and I agree with that okay. rule, and I think that's great. I'm saying if someone chooses not to follow that
right.
rule, then they take personal responsibility. And
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Society, you know, people don't take responsibility for
right.
their actions, and it's frustrating.
So right. Yeah.
30-minute conversation on responsibility.
So. Any other questions? Do you have any questions from the audience? We do have some comment cards, so we'll be getting to those real quick. If you have a question, okay. We'll move into the comment section. This is the only one we have. Okay. Okay, so we have one from Ron Holt, followed by Al Robb. Did you want to do this? So next portion. Okay, thank you. So, Rob Holt. Ron? The next portion too? Okay. All right. Great. No comments from the audience? Any more comments from the RAC? Go ahead, Wade.
So I live in the same camp that Mike does. I wake up thinking the same way Mike does, I think, a little bit on this stuff. I want all the gloves off. I want people to be able to catch coyotes and do whatever they want unrestricted. And if the Department of Ag is in charge of this, I want them to be in charge of it. But I just don't see it that simple with this. I really feel like I trap a little bit. I'm decent. I'm not a great trapper. But I've trapped enough to know that you set out a trap. You cannot, with 100% certainty, decide what's going to get caught in that trap or what's not. And so if the division regulates things that could step in the trap with some likelihood, I think there's got to be some wiggle room. I think there's got to be some compromise on this. I love the amendments we made in 2017. I thought we came a long ways. I thought we restored a lot of rights and made this thing a lot easier. I struggle to think we can take that additional step to say that all anyone has to say is I'm trapping coyotes. I mean, I understand what Brian's saying, but the only ones you catch are the ones you actually find with a bobcat. I mean, how many people are sneaking bobcats home in the middle of the night that were just trapping coyotes, but they happen to get home without getting caught? The vast majority. There's not a lot of traffic out on the road during trapping season as opposed to deer season. And so I think there's got to be a little compromise here. I actually kind of like where we're at on this.
Tammy?
I still think that there's an issue with on private property and that, and it's not just trapping season. It's varmints and whatever you've got that's getting into your calf crop, your lamb crops, whatever. In Beaver County, we have raccoon, we got fox, we got badgers, we've got everything in there that's just mutilating all kinds of things. And depending on what kind of trap you're talking about, and over here in Sevier County, I don't know if anybody's here from Sevier, we've got those ground squirrels, towns of ground squirrels. And so I just wonder, at what point does that stop? Does that limitation stop?
Is that a question? Do we have somebody that can
answer
that?
Well, I guess maybe that is more of a question than a statement. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure we get answered for you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should clarify that our intent is not, we want livestock producers to be able to take care of their problems. We're just trying to, address a problem that we saw with the law part. So, again, you know, when the group got together, we felt like,
you know, you can have, you know, your herder can go check. This is just about complying with that check time. So you can send a herder out, you can send your grandkid out, you can send your cowboy out, you can send anybody that you want to, and all they need to do is make the rounds, and they can take care of what's in there. So we're hoping, and that just means the person has to put a number on the trap and go carry on business as usual. Those trap licenses were free for the last year. That was the other thing the board instructed us to do. And we had, I can't remember the exact number, like 2,300 people came and bought those, which was quite an influx. So we think a lot of people just went in and got those, and this would allow them then to authorize somebody else. That's the solution we came up in the committee. But hopefully people still can take care of those problems, because it's important, I agree. They need to be able to do what they need to be able to do to protect their livestock.
John.
Well, I think all you people that trap animals or that do trapping, I take my hat off to you. I think that it's a wonderful sport, and I think that it's great. But as I grew up, everybody could find traps. Either they had them or they could borrow them. And if somebody said trapping rules, we'd say, what trapping rules? There's rules to trapping. And then I read through the packet that I got and saw all those rules. And I thought, if I was a young person thinking about going into trapping and looked at that set of rules, I'd say, maybe I'd ought to go fishing instead.
Don't worry about those rules.
So, I don't know. I guess as populations grow and situations change, we need rules. But the fewer rules and the more freedom that you can give to these trappers, I think the better we are.
Thank you. Any comments down this way? Tammy.
One more. I agree with Gene. I think we've regulated this to death, and I think that on the backside we're hurting the trappers. I've got family that's done this for years, and a lot of them have just given it up. They've just said it's not worth it anymore. I do have one more question. Sorry. Doesn't a state have a predator board that and the rules and whatever apply to that?
There is. Ag has a board that meets once a year to look at livestock predation and look at those numbers, and we go present to that board.
Yeah, so that is under the Department of Ag?
Under Ag, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Did you have a comment? We need to have you come to the mic.
I understand the procedure. I'm just wondering if I could make a comment now and then on the other portion.
We do have a card from you, so that'll be fine. Yes, please come forward.
I'm Al Robb. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. I would like to see, I'm concerned about property rights, even though I'm not a landowner or a livestock person. But I would like to see the wording changed from 600 feet out from a building to 600 feet from their boundary or their land boundaries inside. So that would allow a private person more leeway in checking traps and or running traps for coyotes and so forth. Also, Darren pointed out, or it was talked about, the gentleman with the cap there. I couldn't see his name from up there, but right here, by Kevin Bunnell, about trappers in the middle of the night taking bobcats. I don't think that this kind of regulation, personally, is going to make any difference in those kind of people. We as an association try to teach ethics, especially to young people, and tell them the importance of following the recommendation or the guidebooks and stuff like that. Recommend that they get one every year, read it through, and know what they can and cannot do. But I don't think that this type of regulation or on making them have their, you know, coyote trappers, if the COs haven't been able to catch them for 30 or 40 years, what difference is that going to make unless they, you know, they have the number on there, which most of them, if they're going to be illegal, are not going to do that anyway. But I'm just concerned about those two things, and primarily the property owner's rights being stepped on there. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I'd just like to echo Wade's comments too. I know last year we spent a lot of time, a lot of discussion. There was a lot of time spent on this item at the Wildlife Board meeting. I take my hat off to them that they did kind of send this back and form a committee. I think the committee has done an excellent job. That's why we had the committee, and I commend them. It looks like they have some very good recommendations that take care of the bulk of the concerns. So they would have my support. Do you have any other comments? Riley?
I would echo that same thing, that there was a lot of thought that went into this. There was a lot of people that were involved. There was a lot of discussion last year. It went up. It came back. You've got representation from all of these different groups that have done this. And is it perfect? No. Rarely are the things that we discuss at these meetings perfect. It is progress, and I would hate to see that progress taken away because there are still a few things that we need to work out. I would say that we take those other recommendations and we look at those and we try to make it better if we can. But what they have done is good. There's a lot of time and effort that went into that. And I think we need to look at that and move forward with that progress.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Berna?
So is this committee an ongoing committee, or is it just formed just for this issue?
It was formed just for this specific issue at the direction of the Wildlife Board.
Okay, so it's dissolved now then?
Right, yeah. That doesn't mean we couldn't get the group together again if we wanted to.
Okay, I think we're ready to entertain a motion. Brian?
Make a motion that we pass as presented.
Okay, do I have a second?
No second.
Okay, you can comment in just a minute. Okay, we have a second from Wade. Now, any comments, Mike?
Mike?
Can I amend this motion to include a few things, or
absolutely.
Okay, then.
If we get a second.
Okay, if we get a second, that's fine. But I hear what the Trappers Association is talking about private land. That concerns me, and I would like to see the committee, I guess, look at rule conflicts or lack of rules from the DUDA that allows still that get out of free card or get out of jail free card that's hanging right there. Regardless of whether we like the recommendations or not, the legislature hasn't given that approval to the division to regulate coyotes, period. So it's still hanging out there, whether we like it or not. So I would, my recommendation or my motion would be to also have that committee revisit and make it joint.
Okay, we're going to give you just a second to make it
a little
kind
better.
Of concise so we can get you in the minutes.
Okay, the first part of that, what do you call them? Amended motion, the amendment is to look at the 600 feet boundary on private land, and rather than have the 600 feet, bring it out to the landowner's boundary and work and within and 600 feet within.
Okay.
Is that pretty much what you're looking for, Al? And then the other one would be to have UDA and DNR get together to make sure that whatever rule they pass is sufficient. Because right now I think it's not.
Okay. Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second from Tammy. Do we have any discussion on the amendment?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a concern with that because we can't make a motion that would require UDA to do anything.
No, a recommendation we can.
That wasn't what you said.
Well, then with a recommendation, the motion with the recommendation, that they get that group to back together to look up, shoring up the regulations that are on the books and this new regulation as presented.
Okay, does that go with your second as well? Okay, further comment, Wade?
So Mike, I like where you're going with that. I really do. I fear the second half of that might kill the whole thing. We don't need a motion to make a recommendation. What if you include the first part as part of your amendment, and then after we get done voting, we make another motion to recommend something?
That's fine.
Is that cleaner? Feels like to me.
Okay.
I personally don't care if the... Thanks, Wade. I, as far as my motion goes, I don't care if we let the private landowners trap on all the way to the edge of their property or 600 feet from a building. So I'd actually let that into the original motion.
Okay.
If, wait then, a second.
Then, we're,
a second
all, then we're all we're left with is a recommendation at the end. Okay.
Okay. So is that okay with the second? Okay. So the original motion, as presented with the 600 foot addition to the property line. Okay, and we have a second. Do we have any further discussion on the main motion? All those in favor? Okay, that's unanimous. Okay. Now,
the other motion that I would make is that we, or I guess a recommendation that I would make is that we suggest the DNR and the UDAF get together and work out those authority conflicts.
How do we have that? Is that through a...
You can make a motion that we
recommend. Okay. We're going to make a motion that we recommend that. Do we have a second of that motion? Okay, we have a second. Do we have discussion? All those in favor? Unanimous, thank you for your help. Okay, that is item number 5. Now we're going to item number 6. What's the fur bearer and the bobcat harvest recommendation?
This is not a good sign.
Okay. Just while I'm getting this up, just to clarify, so what you just did is what you just recommended was that on private property, trapping rules for coyotes, it's right. You can trap them. You don't have to mark your traps. Right. Okay. All right. Just so I just wanted to have that clear in my mind. Thanks. Right. That's right. Bobcat Furberry on that one. Yeah. Okay, moving right along. The next presentation, when it comes up here, we're making tonight. So now that we've tackled the rule, we're going to make some specific recommendations for next year for bobcat and fur bear take. I'm going to lose something for Phil here tonight, I think. So just quickly, just to remind everybody how we manage bobcats in the state of Utah. Bobcats are managed according to the bobcat management plan that was developed through a similar process to the last item we talked about. There was a committee that was put together, looked at all the latest science that was available, talked through issues, and came up with some recommendations. And so the way that we manage bobcats is by three criteria. We look at those criteria. If two of those criteria are outside of our management parameters in a way that would negatively affect bobcat populations, we will recommend changes either to season length or to the number of bobcat tags that a person can get. If two or more are within, then we would recommend no changes. So you could have six bobcat permits per individual, no cap on permits. So let's go through each of these. So the first criteria is the number of juveniles in the harvest. We want that to be between 42% and 56%. That would indicate a stable or growing bobcat population. So if it's higher than 56%, that just means that there's more reproduction going on, and that's okay according to the plan. If it's lower than 42%, that would be one that would be negatively affecting populations potentially, and one that we'd want to take a look at. So here's the data on that. This is from 1999 through last season. The percent of juveniles in the harvest, the management targets are there in the dotted red lines, and you can kind of see how that's gone. We're right in that spot, just a little bit over 50%. This year, in the last 5 years, we've been at or above on that. Again, above is okay. The second criteria are adult survival. So in order to maintain or grow a bobcat population, you have to have a sufficient number of adults surviving year to year in order to reproduce and add to the population. So we want to see that target be between 65% and 72%. Again, here, higher is okay. That just means you've got higher adult survival. You should be seeing a stable, increasing bobcat population, and it can sustain harvest. If it gets lower than that, we may be seeing a decline in that population and want to do some things to mitigate that. So here's the data on adult survival. Again, the red dotted lines is the management target. The dark line is the data. You can see that last year we were actually right on the line at 65, and this year we're below at just over 55%. So this one is outside of our management targets in a negative way. Third criteria, the percent females in the harvest. If you can maintain a certain acceptable percentage of females in the population, you should expect to see reproduction in a growing population. So in this case, we want that to be lower or within those management parameters. So between 41 and 45, if it's lower than that, it means we're not taking a lot of females and they should be still in the population reproducing. If it gets higher than that, we might be having an impact, and we want to take a look at that. So here's the data on that. Again, red dotted lines, that's the management parameter. And the dark line is the data. We're right on the upper bounds on this one. So we're within the management criteria, but we are on the upper bound. So just to summarize, here's what the last 3 years have looked like with the management range on the outside or on the right-hand side. In this case, we're actually out on one, on the adult survival, but the other two are within management objective. So according to the plan, we're not recommending any changes this year. There'll still be six tags available per individual person. These are the season dates adjusted for the calendar, and no cap on the number of permits sold. other fruit-bearing species. We're recommending the following seasons. These are just seasons, same seasons as last year, adjusted for the calendar, so no change there. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the rack? Okay. Gene?
How do you determine adult survival?
It's an analysis that's based on the probability of seeing an age distribution just at random. And there's a lot of statistics. it's called a chi-square analysis, but we look at what you'd expect just at random and compare that to the data that we see from everybody has to check in those cats, and we age them using teeth. And through that analysis, you can determine about how many of your adults are surviving year to year. And there is a confidence interval. There is some error, but it's fairly good. So that's how we do it. Without having a lecture on statistics, that's kind of how it goes.
Sounds like a swag to me.
Yeah, right. Science.
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, how does have you done anything, any comparison on how the fur market impacts take?
Yeah, generally what drives take is the price of the pelts. What we think we're seeing here with the lower adult survival number is a decline in prey. We've seen rabbit populations decline over the last couple of years, and that's probably driving the decline more than anything else. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. If we see that prey base continue to decline with drought, and based on the trends we're seeing here, we may see some adjustments in the next year or the year after. It's kind of heading that way.
Okay, anybody else? Do we have any questions in the audience? Okay, we'll move to the comments section. So, Al, we'll go to you, followed by Ron Holt.
Al Robb, Utah Trappers Association. Primary thing I want to talk about tonight is short and sweet on other fur bearer season dates. Beaver and mink, marten, badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel. The start date is September 22nd, 2018. I would like to see that move back to October 22nd, primarily because of primeness of the fur. Granted, a lot of people that know that, understand primeness isn't going to go out there and trap, but there are trappers that will, inexperienced or what have you, that will go out and try to catch those species, and it's a waste of a resource because their fur is not prime. A fur buyer won't take them, neither will a taxidermist. So I'd like to see that start date changed to October 22nd for those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So Ron Holt, followed by J.J. Brewer.
Ron Holt, Utah Trappers. All the states around us have no limits on bobcats. We are limited to 6. I would like to see that change, that we are unlimited too. Thank you.
Thank you. JJ? Do you have any other?
I come up here. JJ Brewer, representing myself. I'm a houndsman. I have hound dogs.
Come up, go ahead and
trust
with
Mike. You got it. Okay, JJ Brewer's my name. We're good. Monroe, Utah, representing myself. However, I'm not a trapper. I've enjoyed listening to trapping. I'm not a trapper. I never have.
probably never will. However, I do have hound dogs, so my thought, comment, recommendation would be, would it ever be possible for a houndsman to purchase a recommended hunter not using traps, purchase a houndsman tag, a non-trapping tag for bobcats to allow me to pursue, get bobcats with my hound dogs without taking the trapping course? That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Planted seed, it sounds like. Okay. Is that it? Do we have any other comment cards out on this item? Okay. Any comments from the rack, Mike?
Maybe more of a question. When does the bobcat plan expire, or when do you need to do a new one?
Mike, I think that's on a 5-year rotation, and I believe that was looked at again in 15. So we'd be up in 2020 to do that again. I'll double check, but I think that's where we're.
Okay. Any other comments from the rack?
I've got a question.
Okay.
I guess this is a follow-up question to wildlife. What do you perceive the impact would be if you removed the limit from 6 to unlimited? How would that impact the population?
It depends on what's going on. You know, it depends on what the dynamics are. So I think we'd want to keep the parameters in place. We would need to have a mechanism in order to limit take. I think when they wrote the plan, the concern wasn't that there'd be plenty. The concern was on the low end. And I can go back to those drafts, but you know, during that time frame, we're seeing kind of low numbers on cats, and so. I don't know that they thought about, well, if we can get to that point, do we want to open the gates a little bit more? I would suggest that I think bobcat populations could sustain that if they're in a growth phase, and we could certainly look at that, but we'd have to change the plan to do that.
Question while you're standing there. I'll save you a step or two.
I know, I should just stay here.
So if we did ask that you change the date that you back it up, because like I said, I have family that traps, so
yeah.
I understand the benefit of backing that date up. Is that something that has to be with a plan change, or is that
no.
deadline something that
season dates aren't
seasonal?
In the plan. I think what they wanted to try to do with the September date was allow people who not necessarily trapping for fur to sell, but maybe do some control work, because that's the only time you could do some preemptive control on some of those species if you had concerns. But biologically and fur-wise, Al's 100% right. Those furs aren't prime until later on. So, yeah, I don't know that, you know, it wouldn't worry me from a population standpoint.
Any other comments or questions from the rack?
I do have one I'm going to ask real quick. Is the license, so the gentleman's asking about, you know, getting bobcat licenses to shoot them with hounds. Is that, it's a fur bear's license, not a trapping
right.
license, correct?
Right. Yeah, you have
if
to have
a
fur
bear. If it's a trapping
bear.
License, I'd probably agree. If it's a fur bear's license, that changes it.
It is a fur, it is managed under that. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. You need to summarize before we make a motion? Do you want to summarize for us, Teresa?
So we've had suggestions to move the start date back to October 21st to 22nd for prime fur. Other surrounding states don't limit bobcat take. We should consider being unlimited. And then look into can houndsmen chase bobcats without having the requirement of taking a fur bear course and going through that process.
Okay, perfect. I'm ready for a motion. Brian.
Make a motion that we pass the recommendation as presented by the division.
Okay. That could be an amendment if somebody wants to try it. Do we have a second on the motion?
Yes.
Okay, we have a second. That was by Wade. Now, any discussion or amendments we can address? Mike?
Then I'll make an amendment that we move the startup date for trapping bobcats to October 22nd.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay, we have a second by Vernon. Any discussion on the amendment? Wade.
I like the theory. I like where we're going with that. But it's a little bit like me making a motion that we only shoot 180 bucks. Can't shoot anything below 180 inches. It promotes the resource, makes sure there's more deer next year, better deer next year. And I actually love that idea. I'd love to make that motion. But at the end of the day, we trounce on the guys that just want to go shoot something for meat, the guys that want to go do it for fun. I'm having a mountain struggling with that idea.
Brian?
I had the same thoughts along Wade's thinking there, too. I don't hear that we're having a biological impact. I don't see that it's impacting the resource. It seems almost more like it's a social issue, and if it's a social issue, I really agree with Wade. Why would we limit people on being outdoors and recreating and enjoying what they want to enjoy based on our preconceived ideas of what's right and wrong?
Okay. Mike?
One thing I don't think you're taking into consideration is the condition of the fur at that time. You're wasting a resource. Yes, you are, Brian. And have you ever taken a fur and sold it?
Not everyone that traps sells their furs.
No, but who's going to keep a non-prime fur to hang on their wall?
Who's going to keep a two-point on their wall?
Your apples and oranges.
That's my point. That's my point, Mike, is just because I want to enjoy the outdoors a certain way doesn't mean I got to force that on everybody else.
No, and I'm not saying you have to. You can enjoy the outdoors, but the reason bobcats are trapped is for the fur. 99.9% of the trapping done, that bobcat is sold. Whether you agree with it or not, it is. And if it isn't, it's probably spoiled.
I'd just like a clarification. We're not talking about bobcats. We're talking about marten, badger, gray fox.
Yes.
I know what the
no,
amendment
the,
was, but the
startup date for the bobcat
finish.
Trapping
let,
is a
let me say, let me finish. I know what your amendment was, but the recommendation was on the other fur bear dates, moving that. Just FYI.
No, I don't think so.
You know, Mike, I just have one more comment there, too. I agree with you. 99 point, you know, the bobcats are trapped for fur, and 99 point whatever trappers aren't trapping till October 21st. Why are we regulating the .04?
Well, you may have some inexperienced trappers that want to get out there and catch that slim bobcat.
And it's a minimal impact to the resource, and they're also shooting two
Brian,
points.
Wait till we
so
get the mic.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I just different opinions.
Well, that's fine, and it also doesn't have the impact on the population.
Okay. Brian, did you have a comment?
If they're trapping for money and they can't sell their fur, it's called personal responsibility. They'll figure it out. I mean, I don't know why we got to I agree with you, Mike. I just don't know that we got to regulate it. Let them figure it out.
Then why do we even have a September date?
Okay, so we have no...
We have an amendment and a second. Is there any further discussion on the amendment?
Yeah, I would just like a clarification just for the minutes and for me on what we're exactly we're talking about. The dates on the Bobcats are already set for November. The other dates were September 22nd. Those are the ones that we were talking about moving to October. I would please like some clarification before we try to move the Bobcat from November to...
So the motion is moved earlier.
Yeah.
These are the ones you're talking about, right, Al? Okay, yeah. So these are the dates, right? Sorry. There's the Bobcat.
I changed my mind. I support Mike's motion.
Okay.
Thank you, Aaron. May I say something?
If you come to the mic. Please come to the mic.
If I've got to get up, you've got to get up, Al.
You mentioned about maybe doing control work on some of these species. Doesn't that fall under depredation or something
Yeah, if there's an active situation, you're authorized to do that. So what I was thinking about is if you don't have an animal actively into your chickens or something like that, but you want to go ahead and try and lower the population, you'd be able to start a little bit earlier. But that's really the only reason. And the reason it's not earlier than that is because you've got young of the year that we're concerned about orphaning, and we want to make sure people aren't.
The point I wanted to make is if someone is having problems with those animals, killing their chickens or whatever, they contact the division to get a depredation permit or something like that. Isn't that correct?
They can get a permit, or they can just simply take it, but they have to turn it in within 48 hours.
Okay. We're concerned with the resource.
Right, I understand.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion?
I guess I'd ask a question. So we have this amendment on the table, but the amendment now would be moving the date forward. So I'm wondering can we withdraw that amendment? Would you want to withdraw it just to clean this up, or do we need to vote on the amendment?
Well, I'm still stuck on the impacts of the resource because you're taking more bobcats at that time when it's good trapping weather. When the winter comes, you're limited by the freezing traps, and therefore, I think a lot of unnecessary bobcats are going to be trapped, and then it may impact how many you're going to trap the next year.
So, Mike, but your amendment is to move the dates earlier in the year. Currently, the date's November 14th, and you're asking for it to be October 22nd.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought we was down to September 22nd. Okay. Then I stand corrected. I withdraw.
Okay. Now we have a motion to pass as presented. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All those in favor? Gene, are you going to vote?
Yeah.
One way or for or against. Okay. All those in favor, one more time. Thank you. All right. Move on to item number 7, which is...
Mike, I checked the Bobcat plan. It was reviewed in 16, and it's on a 10-year cycle. So it wouldn't be up in the plan until 2026, but the board can direct us to do that anytime. And we're always looking at the latest data, trying to make things better, and the division could initiate a review of that as well. But that's the schedule.
Thank you. Item number 7 is the Cougar recommendation and rule amendments for 2018 and
2019. Okay, it'll probably be fine. Well, good. Now that we've moved through the controversial stuff,
Let me move on to something a little bit less contentious. So here are our 2019 Mountain Lion recommendations. Just quickly, like I did with Bobcat, I just want to remind everybody how we manage cougars in the state of Utah. They are managed according to the Utah Cougar Management Plan. That plan was enacted in 2015, and this is the plan that's on a 5-year. I was confusing the two. So every 5 years, that's up for review, and it runs through 2025. That plan was put together by the Cougar Advisory Group. Some of you may, I'm trying to remember, anybody here on that group? You weren't, were you, Wade? It had a broad cross-section of interest groups, including houndsmen, mule deer enthusiasts, sportsmen for fish and wildlife, non-consumptive, scientists, a big group. They met multiple times. They reviewed all the latest science that was available at the time and came up with these recommended management parameters and a goal. So the statewide goal for cougar management in Utah is to maintain a healthy cougar population within their current distribution, while at the same time considering human safety, economic concerns, other wildlife species, and maintaining a hunting tradition in the state. And it defines a healthy cougar population as one that has a reasonable proportion of older age animals, breeding females, healthy individuals, and that are in balance with its natural prey and has genetic variability through the population throughout the state. So how does that get implemented? Similar to bobcats, we have management parameters. For lions, there's two. The first is that we want to maintain a percent of females in the harvest below 40% over the 3 years preceding the recommendation cycle. So we pool 3 years worth of data and look at that. And the reason we do that is to try to avoid a lot of herky-jerky management decisions year to year. We average those data over 3 years. That smooths out the curve a little bit, and we're not quite jumping all over the place like we might if something weird happens in one given year. The second management parameter is to maintain in the harvest over the last 3 years a percent of adults over 5 years between 15 and 20%. The first parameter is to maintain the reproducing section of the population. The second objective is to maintain older age class individuals that tend to establish larger territories and also are able to breed. Now, we do this on a unit-by-unit basis. And so the recommendations you'll see tonight on a statewide level, when you sum all of those numbers up, is just the sum of each individual unit's recommendation. And so each district biologist is making a recommendation based on their concerns, their analysis on an individual unit. The other thing that's important to point out is that the plan allows for adjustments to recommendations on units where prey populations are under objective, when we feel like lions are contributing to that. And the other thing that we look at is livestock. And if we've got livestock problems, we can recommend outside of these parameters in order to address those problems, in addition to other tools that we have. So how do we hunt? There's three hunt strategies that you'll see in the recommendations. The first is a pure limited entry season. That's just like you'd see for big game. It's a set number of permits. You have to draw a permit. That's all the people that get to hunt there. When the season's over, it's over. If everybody's not successful, whoever's successful takes home a lion, and the other folks go home empty-handed. The second strategy is a split unit. On this unit, it's limited entry to begin with, but any lions that haven't been harvested in that, say there's 10 permits, and there's 4 left over, those then become a quota after the limited entry portion of the season ends, And then there would be a harvest objective portion where anybody who had a harvest objective permit in the state could hunt there until that quota was filled. Once they take the additional four lions, the hunt would shut down. And the final strategy is just pure harvest objective. This is a straight quota. We set a set number of lions we want taken from a unit. It's open to anybody that wants to purchase a harvest objective permit over the counter. They can go hunt there until the quota is filled, and then the unit shuts down. And then there's a pursuit opportunity as well, which is an opportunity to track lions with hounds, but not to kill the lion once it's treed. So getting on to some data. This graph shows historic hunter harvest since 1990. The light blue line there is overall harvest. That's males and females combined. That's just the number of mountain lions that have been taken in the state. The darker blue line are males, and the salmon colored line is females. So you can kind of see what those trends look like. In the mid to late 90s, that's been the highest lion take recently. It dropped quite a bit off quite a bit, and then over the last 4 or 5 years, that's been increasing. For the most part, among the male side, mostly males have accounted for that increase. Females have been fairly stable, but a little bit of a bump last year in the number of females taken in the state. This graphic just shows the proportion of males and females in the harvest. And so that first parameter, we're trying for 40% or less. This is statewide, so this is everything put together. We look again, look at this on a unit by unit basis and make recommendations based on a unit by unit basis. But when you pull everything and put it together, this is where we've been. So the bottom part is the proportion of females in the harvest, and the top blue part is the proportion of males. The red dotted line is the management parameter. We'd want to be under that according to the plan. The next graph it depicts the number of livestock depredation incidences and the number of cougars that have been removed as a result of those incidences. So an incident is if you're a livestock producer and you go out and find some dead sheep or cattle or whatever, you would initiate a report with Wildlife Services typically. Wildlife Services comes out, verifies what the cause is, so they will officially verify to us that it's a lion kill. And then regardless of the number of animals taken, whether it's one or two or 10, that's an incident. And so we track that trend over time, the number of times Wildlife Services gets called out because a lion's depredating. And you can see that was in decline since about 2012 until 2016. And we've seen an increase the last 3 years on that, about 5 incidences a year over the last couple of years. And then as a result of those incidences, Wildlife Services will try to take the lion that's causing the damage, and that's in that red line below indicates how that has trended. You can see that trend is up a little bit as well. One other thing before we move into unit by unit recommendations. So we have these management parameters, but we also do some other things behind the scenes to try to look at what we think is going on with mountain lions. And one of those things is a population reconstruction. And I think I've talked about this. We did a training up in Salt Lake on this, and so I won't get too far in the weeds. But it's basically trying to generate a minimum population based on the lions we see harvested. So if you take a lion, you've got to turn it into us. We have our hands on that lion. We know the sex. We know the age from teeth. If you know in last year you harvested 10 four-year-olds on a statewide basis, and it's more than that, but let's just use 10 because the math's easy. You know that you at least had 10 3-year-olds the year before in order for them to be 4-year-olds and harvested in the following year. And you can do that. You just back calculate and you add at each level. And what you can do there is go back in time and figure out, in order to harvest these lions and see them show up at our offices, how many lions do we have in order to sustain that harvest? What that will generate, what's more important than the number, because that's a minimum. We know there's more lions than what we see killed. It gives you a trend, and so we're able to calculate what's going on with the lion population based on that population reconstruction. And that has shown us that over the last decade or so, we've been growing mountain lions in the state as a whole. The trend has been up. We think that we're starting to see a leveling off in the number, in the trend, probably over the last couple of years. If you lay that trend on top of the mule deer numbers, population of mule deer growth, they almost mirror each other. Except that over the last couple of years, we've seen a decline in mule deer. This is typical predator-prey stuff. You see the lions will continue to grow and lag behind, and now we're possibly seeing some leveling, but that's based on 1 year of data, so I want to be cautious, but I just want to inform the RAC of kind of how things look. So based on all of that, here are our unit-by-unit recommendations. What I'll do is, in the interest of time, I'm just going to point out changes from last year. Obviously, if you're interested in particular units, we can come back to it. So first of all, for the northern region, they're recommending increasing permits. Oh, let me just explain this just a little bit. Is there a laser on here? There we go. So in this column here, I'll try not to shoot anybody in the eye. One of the things in the plan I mentioned is that we can take into account prey populations and manage cougar populations accordingly. And so if a unit qualifies for predator management because we have species of concern, it'll be in this column here. BHS is bighorn sheep, and you'll see some for deer as well. If it doesn't qualify, in other words, the prey base seems to be doing fine and lions are probably not exerting any kind of top-down pressure, then it'll just say no and it'll be managed according to the plan. And then this is the harvest strategy. If this has changed in parens, will be what it was last year, and this is what we're recommending it change to. So for Box Elder Desert, we're recommending an increase of 5 permits and changing it from a split unit to a harvest objective unit. On the Raft Rivers, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits. Box Elder Desert, we've got some depredation concerns out there. And the Raft Rivers is just within management parameters, so we're recommending more opportunity. East Canyon, we're recommending an increase of 5 permits and switching it from limited entry to split. This is another one where we've seen a lot of depredation concerns on that unit. It's mostly private, and Wildlife Services has been taking some lions. It's also within the management parameters. Access is the bottleneck on these kind of units with private land. And so it looks like there's two things going on. There's opportunity to be had. In addition, allowing for that, what's going to a split would do is, once that limited entry season stops, landowners can go get a permit over the counter and try to take a lion that may still be impacting them during the winter time. Obviously, the depredation's taking place at a different time, but they could go try and preemptively take some out. We always like to see sportsmen have an opportunity to take these rather than Wildlife Services if we can do it. Morgan Southridge, similar thing, similar strategy. On the Ogden unit, we're actually below objective on females in the harvest, or I guess above it would be more appropriate. They're above 40%. So they're recommending 2 changes. One is reduce it by 1 permit and switching from a harvest objective to split. The idea here is that if we go to split, people might be a little more selective. We may see a drop in that percent females in the harvest. And then 1 less permit that could help with that, so we can monitor that. No changes. We're moving on to northeastern region. No recommended changes on these units. On the South Slope, Bonanza, Diamond Mountain, Vernal, recommending an increase of 4 permits. On the Wasatch Mountains, Aveniquin, Wildcat, an increase of 5. On the Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek North, an increase of 3. Central Mountains, Nebo, West Face, an increase of 3. Central Mountains, Northwest Manti, from 9 to 11. And Central Mountains, Southwest Manti, increased from 12 to 18. Six, right? Okra Stansberry, an increase from 12 to 14, and changing that from limited entry to split. On the Wasatch Mountains, Cascade, and Wasatch Mountains, Timpanogos, both of those are over objective on their females in the harvest, so they're recommending a decrease in permits on those units. On the West Desert, Tintic, Vernon, an increase from 9 to 12. Southern region, on the Beaver, increasing from 9 to 13. On the Fillmore Pavant, an increase from 14 to 19. Unlimited units, just quickly, there's a few of these in the state. In order to qualify as an unlimited unit, this is a unit that's typically remote. It has a bighorn sheep population and very little alternative prey. And so if mountain lions can get into those populations, they can have a quick impact on a sheep population that we're either transplanting or trying to grow. And they're hard to hunt, and there aren't that many lions. And so we can be unlimited. We usually take one or two a year. I think the idea is if someone's out there doing something else, they can have a lion tag in their pocket, and if they see one, they can take it. Right. On the Monroe, recommending increasing from 9 to 15. On the Panguitch Lake, an increase from 10 to 12. On the Ponsagon, we're recommending that we keep the numbers the same, but we switch from a harvest objective unit to a split. And we're also recommending a season change that I'll get to here in a minute at the end. How many years, Teresa, have you had 10 or Josh? 3 or 4 years at 10 on the quota on the ponds? Yeah. And we just don't fill that quota. We just don't hit it. So we're trying to get a little bit creative. The thinking here is that if we go to a split, then 10 people will draw a permit and they can only hunt the Ponsagon. So we're hoping that that'll increase some pressure down there. And then with the season dates, I'll show you how that works into our strategy in a minute here. Pine Valley North, increase of 2. Plateau Boulder, an increase of 2. On the Zion, an increase of 3. On the Plateau Thousand Lakes, change from harvest objective to split. Moving on to the southeastern region. Central Mountains Northeast Manti, they're recommending an increase of 3. Central Mountains Southeast Manti, an increase of 4. No changes on these units. No changes. That's all the unit by unit stuff. Just a little informational graphic here. How the breakdown between harvest objective units and split or limited entry units has gone since 2015 when the plan was redone. We've trended towards harvest objective, and this year we're about 51% limited entry or split, and 49% harvest objective. Okay, season dates. Limited entry, we're just recommending adjusting for the calendar year, so no change there. On splits, again, for all the split units except the Ponsagon, we're recommending the same season as last year. What we're going to recommend on the Ponsagon is that open the same as the harvest objective on the rest of the state, but that it remains open throughout the rest of the year. The idea here is that for a lot of these units, that harvest objective season will close. They'll fill their quota usually by March or February. And this would leave the Poncegon open through the summer. If someone had a harvest objective tag and they wanted to go there, they could go there. And this is an effort to try and see if we can get closer to that quota. I know all the issues about hunting lions in the summer, and the Poncegon is particularly difficult. You just don't get the conditions that you often do in other parts of the state. But this is a way that we want to try this and see if we can get a little bit better harvest on the Poncegon. And we only want to have the Poncegon do this just so that it's the only game in town, so to speak. So, slight change. Harvest objective and unlimited used to have different seasons. Unlimited basically ran year-round. Harvest objective had like a three-day window between the time it closed and then opened for the next year. We're just recommending that both seasons just run year-round. Obviously, if they, on harvest objective, if they meet the quota, they close. And then pursuit season, again, just adjusted for the calendar. Couple of informational items, just so the RAC is aware. Many of you remember with the big game recommendations last fall, we passed, the board passed some changes to the archery equipment requirements, so poundage and stuff like that. So we're just changing that language in the rule as per the direction of the Wildlife Board so that archery equipment's the same across all of our rules. And finally, a couple things, actually one local of local interest, but we're beginning a five-year PhD study with USU to look at mountain lion female survival, kitten survival, predator-prey relationships, and cougar and bear interactions in three units in the state, the Cache, the Book Cliffs, and probably the Manti. We're still working that out. But in addition to that, we're really curious at looking how mountain lions interact with migration corridors on the Poncegon with deer. BYU's interested in collaring some lions down there, and we're going to work with the region to get some lions on the air and see how lions react to some of those deer movements that we see that are pretty unique in the state. And that's it.
Okay. I have a question before you turn it over to the rest of the rack, but if you have a cougar that has a collar on it, is there a restriction?
We're not going to recommend any restrictions at this time.
Okay.
So it could be taken. And we are interested in looking at survival, so we'd want to capture that, although it would easily identify it as a female, and so some folks may pass if okay. They see a collar, but it won't be illegal to take one with a collar.
Okay, great. Any other questions from the rack? Okay, Braden.
Let me ask the question. I'll tell you why I'm asking it. But as I'm looking at this, the female harvest is relatively static. The female percentage of harvest is actually trending downwards over a long-term trend. So percentage is actually trending downwards. Now, the only thing I see on here that maybe is a little concerning is age class has dropped the last 3 years, but overall it's actually fairly static also. So in the interest of me getting some clarity and maybe with questions that I see coming up, what we're really discussing here is not a biological impact to cougars by raising the permits. What we're really discussing is trophy quality.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's how age would play into it, sure. And when you look at those two parameters, the one that's the most important is females in the harvest for maintaining a population statewide. So, and age is somewhat secondary, but it has mainly to do with the size and of the animals that are on the landscape.
So biologically, we're fine. What we're really talking is a social issue. So now my second question that goes along with that, do we have any units identified as trophy cougar units where we're managing for an age class that's similar to what we do with deer or elk?
No.
So currently we don't have trophy cougar units.
Right.
Okay.
Verna.
I'm curious, do you have any data on the livestock depredation such as how old the lion was that was taken, that was causing the problem. Was, are they young? Are they old? Are they male, female?
I don't think there's a trend there. It seems like we do have ages on that, but I haven't picked out any, you know, I think you might think, well, young ones are doing this because they are less experienced and they take the easy prey. I think it just varies by incident. It just kind of depends on okay. on the animal involved.
All right. Yeah, that's what I called a couple of trappers that I or government trappers for the state, but I couldn't get a hold of any to find out what their sense was on that. But that's something I was curious about.
That's something I can pull together, Berlin, for you, because we have those ages. But again, looking at it, I didn't ever have anything sort of pop out at me as, oh, look, these are all young cats. It just seems like some of the sheep guys I know up north will say that it's actually the females with kittens that hit them pretty hard, but I don't know that that's supported in the data or not. I just don't know.
All right. So looked like last year the incidents reported were around 65 and the number removed was 24. So we're not removing a lot.
Yeah, and that it's not for lack of trying, but yeah, they don't just, sometimes they just can't catch them. So ideally you'd want to get the lion that did the killing, right? But that's not always, we're not always able to do that. So secondarily, when we make our unit by unit recommendations, we may recommend, and just as a general rule, when you look at these, if it's about 5 permits increase, there's probably a depredation incident on that, or a prey concern. If it's 2 or 3, that's usually just opportunity. So.
Okay, I guess another question is, we've received a bunch of emails from all over the world. Are they quoting some study that's been done somewhere that you're aware of?
There's a couple of things that have come out lately that I see over and over again in those emails and when I sit down with those groups. One is a study out of Colorado that it was done by Ken Logan on the Uncompahgre Plateau, where he suggested, well, the data he saw from his collared lions is that if you harvest more than 10 to 15% of the independent adults, you'd see a decline in populations. A couple of things on that. One is, if that's true, and I have no reason to doubt that because he had a lot of lions on the air. He had a pretty good idea how many lions he had. We would have seen a decline in our population if we were harvesting that many, and we didn't. So I don't think we're there. We may be starting to get there. But the second study that comes up a lot was a study that Peebles did where they looked at the number of incidences of livestock depredation and compared that to the number of, to the trend in the harvest of lions. I think it was in Montana, but it could have been Wyoming. And they're correlated, and ours are correlated. We see an increase in harvest, and we see an increase in livestock depredation. Be real careful about confusing correlation with causation. The next question is, well, what would cause that? And it could be a lot of different things. And that paper doesn't address causes. It suggests that it's the sort of the young social structure aspect of things. But the study didn't examine, there's no data on that portion. But, you know.
All right. If you could you email me those?
I could, yeah.
Those studies, because a lot of times you need to look at it hard to see whether the study was done right or the, you know, who was doing it, because right. A lot of times they extrapolate data from it that's not, shouldn't be there, and it's not repeatable.
Yeah, the correlation is based on real data. And again, we see a similar thing in Utah. It's just the next step would be, let's look at ages of cougars involved and see if it is young cougars or not. And again, I don't think that we're seeing that here, but I don't know about there. And that was something that they didn't look at.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Tom.
My question was similar on the
on the livestock depredation, that there was a big number. Is there pockets of that? And then you also said that the incidents could be anywhere from one animal to how many?
Yeah, it just depends on, it could be, I can look and see what the max was, but the one I'm thinking of was a bear incident, and it was kind of a weird one. But yeah, it can be, you know, 1 to 10, 1 to 15, somewhere in that range usually, I would say. And if it comes back, you know, they add to that over time. It may not be one night it killed 10, but it may come back multiple times.
So there wasn't any, like, particular unit that was a huge problem?
There are a couple that stood out. If you look at it by county, Morgan and Summit counties were at the most. They had about 13 each. I should look, Tammy, because I think Beaver had 5 or something like that.
Okay.
I've got that. Let me look and make sure.
I know we have some neighbors that have had some big issues.
Right. One other thing on the livestock side that I think is important to mention, too, is that so we pay compensation on verified kills, but that budget is capped. And you may hear from some of your producers tonight that, you know, last year we paid 83 cents on the dollar because we had to prorate, because we outstripped the budget. And this year we had to pay 76 cents on the dollar. So as those increase, and this is all incidents, so this includes bear, everything's thrown into the same pool, but that's concerning to us. And our objective would be to, we don't necessarily need more money, but we need to make sure the money we have can pay for the damage that occurs. So we need to manage to try and keep those that the damage is below that cap.
Yes.
I have one more question for you. Refresh my memory. I believe I understand it, but refresh my memory. What makes a unit a predator management unit, particularly with bighorn sheep?
I think all of our bighorn sheep technically qualify if they're below 90% of the population objective.
Okay, that was my understanding. I wanted to make sure.
I don't think anything's above that.
If that's accurate, I guess the question I've got is, in the last board meeting, it was authorized to transplant sheep onto the minerals. Have we looked at making that a separate unit so that we can do predator management?
That would be up to the region, but I think we'd want to do that prior to. So I'll leave that up to Teresa and her biologists. But yeah, no, we typically, Braden, we do that.
You know, maybe I'll save my comment till the comments. I want to come back and comment on this in the comment period, because that's part of the strategy we discussed with the cattlemen there, that this would be some help to them also.
I'll let Dave get warmed up on that one. Tell us what your cougar population looks like out there.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Do we have any questions from the audience? We'll be moving into the comment portion next, but if you have any questions, clarifications, yes, please go to the mic. Make sure you state your name.
Hi, Michael Hansen. On the graphs, on the incidents, how many incidents, I don't know if I heard right, did you say there was?
70 this year, 65 last year, and 55 the year before. So,
but that's only on your confirmed, that you can confirm.
Those are times that Wildlife Services got called out because, and confirmed, yeah, you're right, and confirmed
and
the
confirmed.
Lion was the culprit. Yeah,
so that's
right.
Skewed numbers. And then the other question, this one really irked me when I saw your unlimited hunt. How come you get to protect your sheep, but we don't get to protect our sheep from your animal? And as far as the compensation money, yes, you need to up it because you owe me $6,000 on what you limit it down to. Just saying. And that's on the verified.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right. Any further questions? Okay. Come to the mic. Please limit it to questions, your clarifications.
My question would be, those depredations, do they count towards your quota numbers?
They do not factor into the management numbers, but we do look at that. And so when a biologist sees, one unit I can think of this year was Morgan Southridge, where they, I think they took four lions, Wildlife Services took four additional, and then there was some other depredation take, and then one got hit by a car. So we want to look at that. In that case, it still was with management parameters, but as a biologist, you may want to adjust your permits the following year based on that.
What about automobile mortality?
Yeah, we look at all of that when that comes in, but it doesn't. The numbers you see on the spreadsheet don't include that.
Okay, let's go to the comment section. We do have a number of comment cards, which we're glad to see, but we will limit your comments to 3 minutes apiece.
Thank you.
The first one is Greg Jensen, followed by Paul Niemeyer.
Greg Jensen from Richfield. I was blessed to have a grandfather purchase four sections on top of the Monroe Mountain. We have family cabins, and I've grown up there. It's just been my backyard. Seen the highs and lows from deer and elk to the absolute low now of deer. I did a quick little Google search today at about in between the 7,000 and 8,000 foot, maybe up to 9, and made a lap around the Monroe Mountain. And the reason I did it at that elevation is our family has cameras that we've had up there for years. And if you do that lap quick around the Monroe, you end up with about 105 miles. You know, the highway's going to be a little bit longer because you can get a little bigger border. And in our little section of cameras on that elevation over the last 4 years, the number of cougar increase of sightings has just been dramatic. In 2015, we had three actual, and there's lots more pictures, but we figured three different cats. And four of the 16 cameras had a picture of a cat. And we saw one just animal just in view. In 2016, we figured five different lions. Four of the 16 cameras had pictures of different lions. Again, many, many pictures of lions, but we figured there were just four lions. And we saw two lions. In 17, nine of the 16 cameras had pictures of cats, and we figured we were at eight different lions. This year, 12 of the 16 cameras have pictures of lions. We figure we're at 10. And we've seen three this year, saw five last year so far. Just in view of just being out and about, I was lucky enough this winter, there was no snow, so I went ice fishing on top of the Monroe every Saturday. And a lion hunter that I was witnessed three Saturdays in a row had a lion treed. I think one day was two, and I know the one Saturday on three canyons just north of this had three lions treed at the same time. If you look at that from our north camera to our south camera is a 5 mile stretch. And I figure there's really close to 10 lions. And the very north of that, he had three lions caught. If you do the math of that 105 mile stretch and that number of lions, are there 210 lions on the Monroe? I don't think so. But to go from 9 to 15 doesn't put a dent in the population. And speaking with the wildlife biologist, the minimum number of depredation on deer, he figures, is 25%, and this is from GPS collared does that they're doing a study on for fawns. Recruitment in deer is not 25%, and if we're killing 25% each and every year, our deer population right now is horrible, and it's just going downhill extremely fast. Okay, thanks.
I'm Paul Niemeyer, representing Sportsman Fish and Wildlife.
Our first recommendation is that we approve our recommendations for the all the Cougar recommendations by the DWR. Secondly, we want to support some recommendations by the Houndsman, making the Buck Cliffs unit a split Cougar unit, which should give Utah residents a little bit more hunting opportunity. And we also support the option reporting Cougar harvest with GPS reporting, just like we're doing, going to do with coyotes. So those are the three issues that we've got. Thank you.
Sorry, Stanton will be followed by J.C. Wilson. You.
Hello, I'm Stanton Glebe. I president of the Paiute County Ranchers Association, but I'm mostly here representing myself tonight. You probably all heard me before. I'd give up on you here. I wasn't going to come back to another RAC meeting. I about decided they don't do any good. If you had 10 ranchers on that board, I think you'd see a whole different situation. If I look around tonight, there ain't too many people here much older than me. I got a comment. This gentleman right here, he's telling the truth when he said in her younger days there was no law on that trapping. Good heck, we all trapped and we took care of those predators. Them predators, I don't care which one of it is, they're so far out of control that, my heck, go take care of them. If you take care of those cougars and those coyotes, you could raise deer. And in Paiute County, that's what we want. We'd like to see a deer herd back, and we'd like to see them out of the fields. Because of those two animals, that's all we have. What few deer there is right in the fields there. You know, I heard a comment when I come in here about all the fires burning. Well, the reason those fires are burning is from 40 years of mismanagement by a Forest Service bunch of people. And that's the only reason they're burning. If you don't log it or you don't graze it, you burn it. This Fish and Game bunch right here is no different. 40 years of mismanagement, you have no deer. When you have no deer and you have no sage hens and you have no pheasants, my hell, take care of the predators. I guess it must be you people to do it, because I go to the state, I say, hey, I pay predator control. What does predator control mean? Does that mean I just watch my sheep herd get ate up, or does that mean that somebody pays me for it? They don't pay me for it. They say go to the RAC board. Well, here I am to the RAC board. That little small amount of 15 cougars on Mount Dutton won't even touch them. I'd say maybe if you took 100, you might start putting a dent in them. Last year I lost 800 lambs after they were docked. 800. I was up there the other day up in West Hunt Creek, and there's a nice big lamb bit right into with coyotes, and just up the creek away is a fawn deer. Chewed to pieces, and before long here comes two Fish and Game officers by me. And I says, you know these coyotes are killing your deer. They don't care. You guys all get paid. The same thing when, if your deer herd's wiped out, you're still getting your money. When my sheep herd's gone, it comes out of my pocket. The old Constitution of the United States says that private property will be protected in this country. If we have to, the sheriff will have to take over, I guess, and protect their property. I don't know, but it's up to you people to take care of them animals right there, those cougars and those coyotes. Thank you.
J.C. followed by Jared Higgins.
I want to say one more thing. When you take care of them animals, you'll have your bobcats back. And these hounds will chase bobcats. We don't.
Stanton, your time's up. Thank you.
I'm J.C. Wolston-Hume, and I'm just supporting the Utah Houndsman Association proposal. These are the guys that spend the time and the money out there and work hard to find a lion to chase. I'm not saying, yeah, you have your days where you can catch more than one or two, but these are the guys that spend the time looking for that too, because that's what we enjoy instead of the deer, the elk, that stuff. That's not our hobby. We enjoy chasing lions, and we should have the same amount of right to go out there, because we spend a lot of time and money just looking for one to chase to take a picture of. So I support their propositions.
Thank you. And Jared, followed by... We got another one by Jared.
Jared, followed by Jared. Then Jeff Brewer. Which one's first, the Houndsman Association or me?
You only get one.
I only get
one. You get 3 minutes.
Well, I'm representing, I get 5 minutes.
Yeah, is there another representative here? Or?
No.
Okay.
I am the representative from the Utah Houndsman Association.
Okay, and you have a letter, right?
Yep. Matter of fact, you guys have that. Have you been emailed that?
So we'll give you two different options, 3 minutes.
Do you guys all have a copy of that recommendation?
Yes.
Okay. All right, you probably read it, so I'm just going to kind of skim over it. The Utah Houndsman Association has reviewed and discussed the DWR's 2018 Cougar recommendations for the upcoming year. The Utah Houndsman Association cannot support such a drastic increase as the tags, as this is not sound management. The Houndsman Association recognizes that the proposed increases do fall within the management plan. The DWR has increased cougar permits drastically over the last 2 to 3 years. The Houndsman Association does not feel that the cougar population is increasing, and believes that in very few areas it is stable or stabilizing. An increase in tag allocations across the state is not warranted and is not the best management practice for cougars. We have the following recommendations, that the Book Cliffs East Cougar Unit be moved from a harvest objective to a split. Last year it was a nearly 80% cougar killed by a non-resident. Number two, the Monroe Cougar Unit have a zero increase. They're proposing a 67% increase on that unit. Central Mountains Southwest Manti have a zero increase. They're increasing at 35% on that. And last year they raised them by three. They've also moved it to a split from a harvest objective. And with those, they've went to almost a 200% tag increase. Number four is the GPS coordinates. We'd like to see GPS coordinates of all the cougar kills when they're checked in. So that wraps that up. So separately, I'd just like to say, the gentleman that's got the trail cameras, the reason why you're seeing a lot more lions in a lot smaller place, there's no more adult lions to run those lions off, to disperse them. Cougar disbursement works that way. When they reach 18 months old, the adults run them off or eat them. When you don't have adult mountain lions, you have packs of lions now staying together hunting smaller areas. Also, to these units that they're having a problem even meeting the harvest on, they're opening them wide open and no cougars are getting killed on them. Well, they're increasing the tags on Monroe, Beaver, Dutton. Why are you going to go down and hunt on the Pontagon when you can hunt on the Monroe? You're not going to do it. But if you limit those tags a little bit, an outfitter like myself, I've got clients coming in, I'm going to go down and hunt what's open. And some of these start filling up, it's going to push us out onto some of those units that you guys want lions killed on. I mean, all in all, the quality of the lions we're seeing out there, they're young. They're 2-year-old lions at best that we're finding most everywhere. You know, I spend 40 to 90 days in the field every year, and I've watched it. I got into the hounds because I was a disgruntled deer hunter. Monroe Mountain. Never missed a deer hunt since I was 6 years old out there. I wreaked havoc on the lions out there legally. Everybody that had a tag, I took them. And I took clean house. guess what? The deer didn't help them a bit. They went down. So all this is garbage. It's a tiny drop in the bucket compared to what's getting hit by cars, what's getting poached, what's getting over harvested by doe permits. You know, it's always comes back to the cougars. It's a small drop in the bucket.
Jeff Brewer, followed by Michael Hansen.
Hello, my name's Jeff Brewer. I'm just representing myself. I've been coming to these meetings and been chasing hounds for 36 years now. Here's my recommendations based off my observations. I'll start with the beaver unit. We're willing, or at least I would be willing, to support a small increase. You know, one of the problems we have at the DWR, sorry guys, is they swing hard one way too fast. They don't move in small increments. So the beaver unit, we would support an increase from 9 to 11. The reason being is that unit is within its recommended amounts. A female is below the female harvest. It shows some adult males. We're okay with a couple there, but swing and clear up just doesn't make biological sense. The Fillmore unit, which gets its pounded to death, we would recommend no increase. It's got 14 tags. It gets hunted super hard. If you look at the data again, the Fillmore unit has a very low percentage of cats with any age, 20%. Females are still under the thing, but they're young cats. The other interesting thing I want to point out on the deer, on the beaver unit, in 15 we gave 3,000 deer tags. In 16 we gave 3,150 deer tags. In 17 we gave 3,350 deer tags. So deer's not an issue because we're increasing the tags, correct? Okay. Fillmore, same thing. In 15, we gave 2,100 tags. In 16, we gave 2,200 tags. In 17, we gave 2,400 tags. And proposed for 18 is 2,500 tags. So not a big deal. Jump to the Monroe unit. Increased from 9 to 15 is out there. I hunt the Monroe hard. I seen Greg on the Monroe a whole bunch of times. I chase lions on the Monroe. Last year's harvest on, no, here's the ages. Actual true ages, lions. 3, 4, 4, 2, 3, 1, 2 years old. Not one lion over 5 years old on the Monroe. Not one. Same thing with the Monroe on tags. 1,500 in 15, 1,550 in 16, 1,550 in 17. Anyway, we'd recommend and we'd be willing to work with the DWR and do 11 tags on the Monroe. The fish lake, we sustain and we agree with the DWR, will stay at 16. The Ponsegaunt, I'll let Hunter Mika maybe, I don't know what to do with the Ponsegaunt or recommendation. I do notice that your female harvest is over their criteria. So by your management plans, you should decrease the Ponsegaunt. According to your management plans, it's 48% females. Anyway, I'm not saying you do that. I'm just saying that there are things here that need to be looked at. Two more quick things. Okay. Thank you.
So Michael followed by Dan Riddle.
Michael Hansen. I only meant to ask about the draft, but I'm still reeling about the unlimited numbers. I definitely support increasing the numbers across the board. I think that is fabulous. But I'm still not impressed that they can protect their livestock and we can't with unlimited numbers of killing them.
Thank you. And then following will be Hunter Meekum.
Hi, Dan Riddle from Central Valley. I just wanted to say I support the Utah Houndsmen's Association's recommendations. We've got a big group of houndsmen that are out there through the winter, seeing these numbers and these lions, And they know those numbers are there. And that these proposed numbers are a detriment to the lion population. Now, from a personal perspective, I'd like to talk just for a minute. I have two sons, a 14 and a 15 year old, a 14 and 15 year old boy. They love the sport and they're into the sport. And in essence, they're the future tools to maintain a generation of population control. That's a primary population tool or control for cougar population. Concern I have is with limiting and lowering these numbers, there's a reason why there's such an outcry from the Houndsman's Association, because they see them lions numbers every day and they know that's a, it's a detriment to the sport as well from there. So leaving that aside, I want to talk about future tools. I take my boys at it, and there's not a lion track to chase or pursue. They lose interest, and they lose interest quick. If we've got game or something to pursue, they're gung-ho. So by eliminating this, by lowering these numbers, you're also lowering and hurting yourself in generations in that predator control. And I truly believe that with these younger boys that are losing this interest that's there. And so with that being said, and I don't think those numbers are there. That, you know, I read an article from our state mammal coordinator last year through the Associated Press last year that estimated the cougar numbers for Utah between 1,900 and 4,000. That's a huge contrast. I mean, really, 1,900 to 4,000 is crazy. And that's an article that was written in the U.S. News, and you were cited with those numbers. Is that correct? I don't want to lose my time, but that is a true statement. That is what's being put out through the Associated Press into the public. So you put those numbers out, and there's a persona that's out there. I mean, if you propose 653 lion tags this year, and you've only got 1,900 cougars that's cited by our coordinator, I mean, you've decimated that population, and these guys see that number and that amount, and so there's a reason for that outcry, and I think there's a fine balance in between, but these numbers are ridiculous. I mean, I love to hunt these local mountain ranges, and those proposed increases will swing that pendulum to where there's no sport and there's no predators. Thank you.
So Hunter will be followed by Dustin Clark.
I'm Hunter Meekin. I'm representing myself. Just a couple things I want to talk about. Jeff Brewer and Jared Higgins knocked it dead on the head. And me as an outfitter, taking quite a few hunters, and the problem we're seeing is age numbers. It's hard to kill a three-year-old tom anymore. And I think a lot of that is guys are getting pretty good at just strictly killing toms, but also number in tag increases. Also, two units, the Ponscott one, there hasn't been many lions harvested, but it's over the 40% female quota, and also the Buck Cliffs. That's pretty much all I have. Thank you.
So Dustin be followed by Cannon.
My name is Dustin Clark from Cedar City. I represent myself. First, I want to say I support everything that the Utah Houndsman Association has put forth. I think they have put together the work and the time, and they know these recommendations. They know the Cougar Plan. They spend lots and lots of time going through that. Second off, I would like to support and second everything that Jeff Brewer had to say as far as these units around here. He knows them. He hunts them. I hunt the same units. We see these numbers, and I agree with everything he said. One thing I think that should be an issue that's addressed is the 48-hour rule on turning in your cougar harvest. Time and time again, that rule gets put into place, and units get over-harvested every time. You know, we almost had an issue with the Monroe this year. Luckily, some houndsmen stepped forth, put the numbers straight, and stopped it from being over-harvested. I mean, not that it's anything to do with the southern region, but the cache has been over-harvested the last 2 years. You know, there's units in that state, and I think that 48-hour year rule should be addressed. I think that depredation lions should count towards the quota. I don't think that they should be just put into the numbers. I think they should be set in stone with the numbers, that if we go kill a lion on that unit, it should count towards that unit. And as far as these ranchers go, I want to say I feel your problem. I have family that's ranchers. I was born into it. I have extended family that still ranch. But the problem is every rancher that sees a dead sheep, if there's a lion track within a half a mile of it, they assume that that lion killed it. Whether it was coyotes, whether it was just an animal that died and got fed on by coyotes, or a lion actually killed it. And I also think that these ranchers ought to have a list of numbers, because it's hard for the DWR to get straight to these ranchers when they find a dead sheep, dead calf. The Houndsman Association would be more than willing to help. They have numbers of houndsmen in every corner of this state, that if you have a depredated animal, call us. Many of us will leave work, do whatever we can to come help you, because if you have an animal that's killing, if you have a lion that's killing sheep, let's get that son of a bitch out of the population. I'm great with that. I have no problem with that. But why not let us help instead of relying solely on the DWR? They're strapped as it is. Second, I want to know, I have a question for the Fish and Game. Was there not a study as far as that got shut down, but was there not a study about lions being collared around these main depredated areas to help with the numbers as far as what's going on, but it got shut down by the DWR?
Not that I'm aware of.
Last I had heard, they had tried to push a study through.
How long ago?
Oh, not very long ago. That they had tried to push a study through towards putting collars on animals around these high depredation areas to help with the data on as far as depredated animals itself.
I'm not aware of anything recently. We did talk a little bit with USU about the concept, but
I would like to recommend, I know my time's up, I would like to recommend that something like that be put into motion to help with these depredated ranchers.
Okay, thank you. While you're at the mic, did you want to make a clarification on that article?
Yeah, first of all, I want the houndsmen to know I appreciate everything they do and the observations they bring to us. The other thing I'd recommend is if you're not getting with your local biologist on those units, reach out and get with them, I think, because that's where those recommendations start, is at the local level. So it would help them, I think, to know what you're seeing out there. Just a quick clarification on the population numbers. I remember the article, and I think they may have quoted me, but I think they got that number out of the plan. But just based on that population reconstruction I mentioned before, that would suggest that at a minimum, the population of adult animals 2 years old and older, probably somewhere around 2,000 in the state. Right. That doesn't include yearlings and kittens and, yeah, that's, I just wanted to clarify that. I think, right. I agree. Yeah, I don't blame you for that. One thing I've learned dealing with reporters is that they, not necessarily on purpose, they sometimes get it wrong. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. So I guess just back to the point I made before that, you know, in order to have a growing population, and again, this is statewide, and individual units will vary. The other thing is, remember, we're making recommendations based on a 3-year pooling of these numbers. And so, you know, if we had a lot of young lions last year, that still has 2 more years that's factored in. And the idea between in the plan is to, we can look at trends, But the plan is designed so we don't make drastic changes based on a single year of data. So that's built into the process, right, wrong, or indifferent. Thank you.
Okay. So, Canna is next, followed by J.J. Brewer.
Cannon Fullenbaugh from Central Valley. And I just have kind of one thing to say. So everyone kind of sides with deer hunters on this. Everyone kind of just sees it from their point of view. And I kind of like to see Houndsman actually have like a standing point. You know, you know what you mean. I know what I mean. So if you can kind of see it from our point of view, and you maybe see things a little bit different.
Thank you. JJ followed by Scott Stubbs.
JJ Brewer, represent myself from Monroe, Utah. represent myself and obviously my two sons, 5-year-old and 2-year-old. They love to go with me already at 5 years old. I've been hunting hounds for 25 years, absolutely love it. I also have a dedicated deer tag. Love to hunt deer and elk, that's my thing. My comments aren't to argue with anybody, not to prove my points, but here's the data that I've collected hunting in the past year. I hunted the Monroe 20-plus days for mountain lions, which I will do again this year, specifically for mountain lion. Obviously, I was able to catch 7 lions total is what I caught on that mountain. 2 females, 3 young subadults, 1 tom, which we did harvest, which was one of the 4-year-old toms. We spent a lot of time to do that. If you look through the study that Clint Meekham did on the Monroe specifically, we've talked a lot about the Monroe. The Monroe actually has and always has had a high mortality rate on lions, especially young lions. If you add all the combined lions that were killed this last year, it was an average age of 2.7 years old. So you combine that on the Monroe specifically with a high mortality rate, you're asking for trouble for the future for your lion population. I understand it's hard to make everybody happy, and I wished as ranchers, as houndsmen, as outdoorsmen, we need to stand together because the adversary really is out there pushing to where there's no hunting at all. So we've got to try to find a better, easier middle ground. I would like no increase on the Monroe. However, I would be able to allow for a couple increase on the Monroe to help satisfy, maybe 9 to 11 at most. And I spent a lot of time on there. Same thing with the Pavant or the film where I spent a ton of time up there, 20-plus days, caught 5 total cats. 3 of them were females, 2 were toms. Both toms were harvested. And we've talked about the deer numbers. One more thing I'd like to talk about is I think we need to propose or discuss one of the issues, and that would be that in this past year our division was unable to have enough time to actually look and see how many tags or how many lines have been harvested between the limited entry and the harvest objective, not giving us a true number. So I would propose that we need to extend that from 4 days to at least a week minimum, so we wouldn't begin the hunt until March 2nd, giving our biologist and division more time to collect that data so we have a more correct number on what's actually been harvested. I'm all for what Dustin said. I'd love to help these ranchers. I'd love to help everybody. That's what we do. I'm a phone call away. I love to chase lions. So you're getting better houndsmen than we've ever had, guys that can catch in the dirt, that can catch on the Ponce gun. We can help. I think we need to try to come together and really try to see each other's point of views. I really think that's important. Thank you.
So following Scott will be Brett Bailing.
Scott Stubbs, representing myself. I support having a healthy, huntable lion population. I have houndsmen in my family. At the same time, I would like to see... Is my time up? At the same time, I would like to see some of these livestock losses factored into the numbers. We're losing lots and lots of money. Yes, it's to us personally, but it's to our communities and our economies, and we can't keep taking this. So I really appreciate those that have offered to come catch killing lions. I personally would like to have the help if they kill my sheep. But I do want you to know that I can tell the difference between a coyote kill, a lion kill, an arrow through one. I can tell what it is. So verifying it, it probably needs to be by a government trapper or some authority, but if it's just good by the common person, I can tell. I can tell the difference. And anyway, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Brett, be followed by Will Talbot. And that looks like the end of our comment cards, unless we've missed something out there.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the livestock depredation numbers. Throughout the state, we've talked to ranchers, and we recognize that you can only report statistics on what's reported as far as confirmed kills. But we think that in talking with a lot of the ranchers, there's probably two issues. One, they're not getting the kills confirmed for a number of reasons, and we need to address those reasons to get those confirmed so we have accurate data. But we think that it's probably closer to around 25% of the kills are being reported, actually. And if you look at the ranchers and their losses, we really need to help them any way we can with depredation. And we really appreciate the houndsmen if they are willing to chase down some lions that are problem lions. We sure appreciate that. We also need help from Wildlife Services in confirming kills. And if there were ways that we could have ranchers have smartphones and some other DWR employees able to confirm kills instead of just government trappers, that would really help us in that problem. And then finally, what we'd recommend is if we come up with a multiplier effect like they're doing in Wyoming and other states, where if you have a confirmed kill, you compensate them for three or four or a different number so that you actually compensate the rancher for their losses. And this way we can have a healthy cougar population and we keep our ranchers in business, because we're really concerned about our sheepmen and our economy in the state of Utah, and we want to do everything that we can to help them. So we support the recommended increases, and we thank you for your help and helping us address these issues and keep our ranchers in business. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett.
Will Talbot, Paiute County Commissioner, Sheep Rancher. Just a few little numbers that we put together between Paiute and Wayne County, Stanton's losses, our losses of about 750 head a year ago. That if you add them two together, that's $1,500. If you do the math on what them lambs were worth a year ago, that's about a $275,000 loss in Paiute and Wayne County. We can't take that loss no more. 21 years ago when I bought that permit on Monroe Mountain, I lost two sheep. When I hadn't run there for 2 years, I lost 250 the last time I was there. Lions are a huge problem. There's no money in our economies for mountain lions. We need these ranchers to survive and stay in our towns so we can survive. I've lived on Monroe Mountain my whole life. I was a houndsman till 15 years ago. We hunted them. We found plenty of them. We found a lot of dry streaks too. So I can see both points, but the ranchers are the ones that's got to stay. So I support the increase for the Monroe Mountain, all statewide increases that DWR. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the comment section now, and we'll see if we have any comments from the rack.
I don't think we have any.
That'd be refreshing, not man under the table.
Take Ryan's mic away from him.
Okay, for one thing on the houndsman, you guys got cards? Pass some cards out with some phone numbers, because I know a bunch of guys that'll be calling you.
Okay, go ahead.
I talked to a few houndsmen in down my neck of the woods, which is southwest Utah, and they say there's plenty of cats out there. They can find a cat track anytime the conditions are good, and it's a lot easier now to find a cat than it was a few years ago, so I think there's plenty of cats. The young cats kill just as many sheep and deer as the old cats do, so as far as maturity, I don't know how you get there, because the young cats are there. You just got to grow them, and I think that probably relates back to this chasing and treeing and letting them go thing. You educate the old ones, and so they don't tree nearly as easy. So.
Okay, thanks, Craig. Verna?
Yeah, I've always thought when we have a bear kill or a lion kill, why can't we go get the local houndsman and go get it done right now? But, you know, it's alluded to here that there's some legalities, some different things got to be, got to go through the steps. And when you go through those steps, they probably won't let you houndsman chase them. I don't know if they would, but you guys are part of the problem, because, you know, I've heard listed, well, we treed 7 lions, and we had 1 male that was over 4, so we killed it. Treed 5, 3 females, 2 toms, we killed the 2 toms. Maybe we need to look at this deal like we do in some units where they're hunting deer, where we do a management hunt, take the young ones out so you can get your trophies. If those big cats aren't killing and eating the young ones, and then we've got too many young ones, maybe you guys need to start thinning those young ones down. If you haven't got it looks to me like you guys are hunting trophies, and that's pretty much what DWR raises, what they're want the state of Utah to be, whether it's elk or deer, bighorn sheep or lion. There's a problem there. You're kind of between a rock and a hard spot, raising trophies and not having too many on the landscape for the resource. And when that resource gets short, whether it's because it's an inexperienced cat or the prey's not there, then they'll spill over into the livestock. And it's not always just that with lion and predator. They'll kill for fun if they've got a chance to get into a herd of sheep. So there's some major problems here, and I don't know how we're going to work them out, but in my mind, that's what the DWR needs to be looking at, is how we're going to manage for, number one, older cats for you guys. Number two, decrease the population so we don't have so much predation on the livestock. Thank you.
Braden?
Got a couple of comments. Before I get to that, I guess I just want to thank everyone for coming. This is the most well-attended cougar meeting I've seen. It's good to have both opinions here, too. It's real good. One thing I do want to comment and ask is I'd love to see some of you guys up at the board meeting here in the next little while. You're going to see a whole different crowd up there. They don't like any of you. So, you know, it's great that we're all down here, but, man, we need some of you up there. Couple comments I have. I don't know that I know how to figure out the balance. Honestly, it's a tough balance to figure out, and I'm not sure how to figure that out. But I do have a couple other things I want to bring up. Actually, a question, Teresa, maybe. They indicated that you may be the one on the minerals unit. What would it take to get a minerals unit with the sheep depredation?
I'm trying to think what we did on the Oak Creek. I think we just turned it.
It was already its own unit.
Yeah, we'd have to split it into a Beaver West unit, mm-hmm. and do an unlimited harvest objective. I think that's what we did for a couple years on the Oak Creek.
would that be a motion that we need to make? Is that something that you handle? How do we move forward on that?
If that's what we wanted to do for preemptive actions, which we often do prior to moving bighorn sheep, I mean, I always want the district biologist to have input on it, but that's a way we could go, is split it into a Beaver West and do it would fall under bighorn sheep removal, so a harvest objective unlimited, I believe.
And we'd make a motion here or something?
It would probably best be made right here to take okay. forward to the Wildlife Board.
All right, I'll do that in a minute. Then the next comment I had, and somewhat similar to what Vero was saying down there, is I would love to figure out a way where we can do both, you know, where we can help everybody. I asked the question earlier, do we have any trophy cougar units? Man, I'd love to see a trophy cougar unit. I don't know how you go about doing that. I guess you ask the cougar hunters what deer tags they have and then put a trophy on there, and that makes about as fair as you could do. I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but I don't know how you go into somebody's backyard and say we want to increase cougars on this, but I do like the idea of a trophy cougar unit. I really do. We have that on all the other species. So I'd love to see that, and I think that would make a lot of people happy. I don't know the solution there, however.
Tony. Oh, Mike.
I know several of the houndsmen has brought up, well, let us know and we'll be down there to hunt them on the Ponsagon or whatever. And I've seen that tried in Idaho, where they went so far as to make a list of houndsmen that could leave at the call, because it's very important to get down to where the kill is within a couple of days, or that lion's going to be gone for 2 weeks, and then trying to guess when he's going to come back in there, it's just a shot in the dark. And one of the biggest obstacles I seen come out of that was most of you guys probably have jobs, supporting jobs during the week, to where you can't leave right on the spot. So it's kind of difficult, and especially if you're going to travel from Richfield or Salt Lake clear down to Kanab and down in that country and spend 3 or 4 days, you know, you got to have the time to do it. Great if you're right here on the Monroe and you're living right here, then maybe you can get the time off. But anyway, that's just some problems I see with, and it can be worked out, I'm sure. You've probably got houndsmen down in all parts of the country, but maybe create a list and just try it out.
Riley.
So I appreciate all the houndsmen that came out tonight. You guys are very well represented. Very well represented. And also appreciate the representation from the livestock guys, as well as I appreciate the division. You guys have worked hard and you put a good plan together. There's been a lot of data tonight that's been presented, not just personal opinion, which personally I appreciate. And too often time this becomes just a social thing, and it doesn't have anything to do with the data and the numbers and all of that. And you guys have pulled a lot of data together, which has been interesting for me to see. And the houndsmen are, you are sportsmen. That's who I represent. And so listening to you guys, I'm definitely willing to find some common ground on some of these numbers and stuff. I don't know what that means. I'm a big sportsman, and I hate seeing swings with the one way or the other with deer numbers and with elk numbers and permits and all of that. And I don't know what that means, because I don't know some of these units like you guys do. Some of the ones that you've talked about in particular with the Monroe, I have no issue if that increase isn't what's recommended by the division, if it needs to be less than that. Some of the other ones that you've mentioned in particular. However, I do think that the division, they do their job pretty well, and they do go off of these trends, and there is science to back that data up as well, and I can appreciate that. So I don't think you can throw any of this information completely out the window and say that we have to scrap it all, or we have to kill them all. That doesn't solve anything. There's always some common ground somewhere. So I appreciate those of you that said, you know what, we don't agree with it, but we know that we've got to find some common ground there. With that being said, I'd need some help from some of the other RAC members, and maybe even from some here, and I don't know exactly what that process is, but I'd like to get some more definite numbers before a motion is made on specific units and on those particular increases.
Can I go?
Sure.
You're kind, Brian. I just want to echo what Riley said. We appreciate you guys being here. We really do, all of you. We need input, and it takes a lot of effort to come here, and isn't a lot of fun standing up at the mic, so thank you for being here and sharing. A couple of points I want to make. The confirmed livestock damages, it's a bit of a travesty to me that we're not paying a dollar on the dollar. And I recognize that is not the division's fault. We need to figure out a way, whether it's through the legislature, whether it's through landowner associations, whatever it's through, these guys need to be compensated, because I agree that the confirmed damages are a fraction of actual damages. I really think we need to address that problem. That really is unfair to me. Many of us are benefiting from wildlife. Elk tags, deer tags, selling for all-time highs. Some of that money could be earmarked. Additional monies could be channeled back into this fund that is capped, which is boggles my mind. How do you cap a fund? We go out and tell the cats to quit killing stuff if we can cap stuff. We can't cap a thing like that. We pay on what is damaged. And again, this is not criticism at the division, because I know this is not their fault. But to me, that's something we've got to fix. That's going to be a process, I understand. I'm not going to be dumb enough to make a motion on that tonight. But that is something we need to address. Third is, I don't want to nitpick, but I'm going to. So many have stood up with the mic tonight and said the division's deer or their sheep are getting compensated for, their sheep are getting protected. And I confirmed this with Teresa. The division does not own any of these. Teresa said not one of those bighorn sheep are hers. And I believe her. Guys, let's be real here for a minute. Wildlife is owned by the citizens of Utah. That is every one of us. That is not the division. Let's place blame where it belongs. It is not on the back of the division. They are carrying out decisions made by the Wildlife Board. Get used to it. Get over it. Quit blaming the division. It's not their wildlife. They don't own them. Lastly, I agree. A couple of gentlemen stood up and said that they wanted to hear, that they wanted the houndsman's voice to be counted. And I agree. Every voice of a sportsman should be counted. And that's absolutely fair. But in the spirit of fairness, I think you guys also need to consider that your vote should count as one. Every deer hunter's vote should count as one. And I hope you all do recognize the fact that you're a little outnumbered. And so consider that. There's got to be a give and take, and there's got to be a fairness in all this. So this is a complicated issue. That's why it takes us so long to muddle through it.
I just wanted to add on to that briefly. Braden alluded to it. When you go to the Wildlife Board meeting, there's another group in the room. All the emails that we've received in the last few weeks have been from that group. We've had very few from out here in the audience or sportsmen. We've had a year or two ago, there was file boxes brought in with a little tote that were probably five or six file boxes high that were petitions not to kill
any cougars in the state of Utah. So there's another group out there that just complicates this whole process. And they're not here tonight, but they will be at the wildlife board meeting and probably outnumber you guys in the room. So that's just another complication. The DWR has to balance all this stuff. They want to be fair to everybody. They want to manage their resource. They want to protect livestock. And personally, after looking through the presentation, as they looked at each unit by unit, it all made sense. It all had thought. And they were doing the best to meet the objectives of everybody here in the room. And from a personal level, I would support the recommendations as presented, with the exception that I think that there's been enough conversations about the mandatory GPS reporting, and that wasn't presented, but I think that's a very good idea personally, and that's my comments, even though I may not have a vote tonight. Brian, I know you're dying to say something.
I've been trying to be good down here. I think we're there. No, I get it. It's a tough deal. I think that this making the Buck Cliffs unit the split cougar unit, it's good. It gives Utah hunters a chance to kill more of these lions if that's what they want to do. It doesn't make it turn into an out of state season. Excuse me. But at the end of the day, you guys with dogs are going to decide how many lions we kill. And you talk about the future and you talk about everything else, and I don't think there's any less houndsmen now than there was 10 years ago. I'd probably say there's more, because that's what I hear, is there's more houndsmen. So I don't think that the future generations are going to be a problem, because every time somebody sells their dog, somebody else buys them, and you see another houndsman. Every truck's got a dog box in it. So I just don't think that the number of houndsmen's going to be a problem or is a problem. I think there's plenty of you, and that's great. It's a great sport, and you guys love it, and that's fantastic. But I don't think that's what we should make recommendations on based on that. You guys have made the comment down here that these houndsmen have lives, and they've got jobs, and they can't just leave to go shoot a lion. And I'm here to tell you right now, my plumber will leave my job to go shoot a lion. Won't you, Dustin? He don't even care. He doesn't even care. He'll tell me to blow it out my rear end and just leave and go shoot a lion any day of the week if somebody calls him. So these houndsmen do it. They're nuts. And they just like to go, chase lions, and that's what they do. Maybe that's why Stanton doesn't like you. Start shooting them. And then, no, that's okay, guys. I get it. Everybody gets to enjoy the outdoors a little bit different. And that was the point I was trying to make earlier, is we all get to enjoy the outdoors a little bit different. And if you want to shoot a one-year-old lion, go shoot a one-year-old lion. If you want to shoot a two-point deer, shoot a two-point deer. The important thing is you get out and enjoy it. All I know is when I finally get to draw a lion tag, I'll have probably 10, 12 points wrapped into it, because there's very little opportunity, and the less the opportunity is, the more points it takes to draw a tag, the more points I've got wrapped up into it. I'll be damned if I'm not going to shoot one. And so when we lower the numbers, are we saving lions? I mean, I know a guy that drew a beaver tag, had 9 points wrapped up in it, would have never stepped foot on the unit if he didn't have 9 points wrapped up into it, came down and shot a lion, only because he had 9 points. And so, you know, we cut these tags. I don't know that we're saving any lions' lives here. I really don't. But as a non-consumptive, I guess I want to see less people consuming lions and lions consuming less livestock. I don't know. I mean, how are you supposed to call this one? I thought that was kind of funny. I've been practicing all week. All right, I'll stop. Now my plumber's going to punch me. And I get that too. I do. I get it. And some of these units is, you know, what these biologists have picked these numbers for a reason, and I don't know the reason. I don't know if the biologist for the Monroe here, everybody talks about it. Is he? I know we're not supposed to ask questions, but I'm going to ask because everybody's brought this Monroe unit up like it's a mythical creature. So why are we tripling the numbers, quadrupling them? What are we doing to them? Raising by four? 67%.
Vance Mumford, biologist for the Monroe unit. So good question. I'm glad you asked that. Yeah, we're going from 9 to 15 tags. If you look at historically, Monroe cougar tags have been a little conservative for quite a few years. What we found with our radio collar studies, I think one of the people already mentioned that we had 25% mortality on our adult does last year, and the majority of that was lion predation. What we found, I believe, there we go. And there is a up there on the board, you'll see Monroe there. The orange color is the, and this is for all does, for all collared deer, including the 6-month-old fawns. That's roughly 50% of the total mortality was caused by cougar predation. If you look at these, just the adult does, it's even a higher percentage. And I think what we found is, you know, we had a good pulse. Our deer really increased several years ago on Monroe. The cougar populations followed that. And yeah, so we've got a lot of lions up there. And now our deer population is coming down. And I want to make sure that when Mother Nature gives us that opportunity to bounce back, that our cougar population isn't hindering that. And so, and I want everybody to know that it's a pretty big increase as far as cougar management goes, typical cougar management. But this can be changed next year or the year after that. So if we find that we are over harvesting, then I will make that recommendation to reduce cougar tags in the upcoming years. So.
Very good. Any other comments?
Yeah. Yeah. First, let me just say, this is great. That's a good chart. I wish we could have seen that. I'm glad we ended up seeing that. That helps get some things in my head, not even just concerning lines, but that's a good chart. The question I had is, I believe it's going to come up as a motion of some sort, is this GPS idea. And everything is not, so when I first heard that, I thought that sounds like a great idea and super easy. Everything costs money and everything has results of quick decisions. So I guess what I'd like to understand from the division, I guess two questions. One, I'd like to understand from the division what that would entail and how difficult it would be to manage. And then two, I'd like to understand from the houndsman, and maybe you could speak to it. I'm assuming you've dealt with this, but what are we trying to accomplish? Because if we're trying to accomplish bad guys not doing bad things, that doesn't do it. Bad guys do bad things. If we're trying to accomplish getting better data and areas, great. But if we're trying to stop bad guys from doing bad things, as was alluded in the houndsman letter, I can't support that.
I had this in there because I figured Monroe was going to come up, and I probably should have just included it in the presentation. But this, you know, this shows all of our deer collar units and cause-specific mortality, and so it's pretty interesting to look at. And there's two standouts, Monroe and South Manti. Going to GPS, I think it's a good idea. I think it could really help management. We'd see where animals are actually being taken and maybe adjust hunt units based on that and try to force more pressure other places. I can envision going to a coyote bounty app similar for cougars and bears. They would also eliminate the lag time between kill, and it'd be almost real time. Having said all that, I'd like to make sure this coyote app is going to work right before we start doing a bunch of extra stuff. And so, we're supportive, and we'd like to move that direction. But if the RAC would give us an opportunity to kind of get our ducks in a row, and you know, these things do take some time to build, and But we definitely want to go that direction. If the RAC wants to start sooner than that, I think the solution would be to just ask for that location when they check in a lion, and that's up to the hunter to give us the right location on that. So, anything else, Braden?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Any more comments? ready to formulate a motion. Braden?
I chickened out. I was about ready to make a motion, but...
Well,
no, I...
Do it, Braden.
I'm going to make a motion. There's no winning on this one, right? So before I make a motion, maybe I'd echo kind of what you said, Dave, is I really do have a lot of faith in the division. At one point in time, I didn't, but I do now. I think the division does a great job. I think they do a really good job. They have these boundaries and side rails, and I put a lot of faith in them, and I think they do a lot of work to come to their numbers. So with that said, I'm going to make a motion to accept as presented, with one additional that we create a sub-unit for the Mineral Mountains so that we can do a predator management area there.
Okay. It's pretty clear. Do we have a second? I have a second from Wade. Any discussion? Bruno?
Well, my discussion would be pertaining to the Mineral Mountains. From what I understood DWR to say, that they, before they would plant bighorn there, they could go through and try to kill all the cougars out anyway. So I don't see why you'd need to include that in any motion. That's common practice from what I understand and what I've...
Okay. Teresa, do you have a comment on that?
and typically the way that we do that is through sport harvest to get our hunters in there and give them the opportunity to do that for us. We can also ask Wildlife Services to do some removal for us, but if there's an opportunity to get our sportsmen to do it, it's better than our staff just going out there. We're not near as effective. I don't know that any of our staff owns dogs, you know, hound dogs, so sport harvest by those guys is pretty effective.
So it's okay if we leave it in the motion and it's not a duplicative effort or anything like that?
Just maybe a little clarification on that, just so you understand. Currently, that's all a big unit with Beaver West and Beaver East wrapped into one unit. The majority, Beaver East is much easier to hunt than the Minerals. So by making it a subunit, you could target that and put tags on that unit, push people there. If you just increase tags on the Beaver unit, they aren't going to go over to the Minerals. You need to make it a subunit so you push people onto it.
Okay. Any other comment?
I like Braden's idea there that if we go with that, it'll give sportsmen an opportunity instead of having Wildlife Services take out the cats. It gives sportsmen the opportunity to do that. The division recommendation isn't enough killing for the livestock. It's too much killing for the houndsmen. I think we're probably right where about where it'll have to be. It won't satisfy anybody, but it'll it's a medium in between. I think they've done a good job in figuring this out.
Okay. Riley?
I guess I'm just looking at this and not necessarily discussing this motion, but I'd like to make an amendment to it before we go on.
Okay, let's hear Riley's comment and we'll entertain your amendment.
I actually want to make an amendment too. So, and it's probably going to be something with a comment though. I've known Darren for a while now, and he does a bang-up job of this, and I echo everything that's been said about the work that's been put in. That being said, I believe in this process, and these boys have shown up, and part of that amendment's going to have to be to change some of these numbers. And for you boys that are still here, I don't know the numbers that I've got written down or what you're looking for, but when I would make a motion for an amendment to increase the Beaver only to 11, Fillmore Pabant by 2, and the Monroe by 2. Have that as the exceptions. Those are the ones that were discussed. That would be the, if we don't reward these guys for showing up, why do they even come?
Okay, do we have a second? Okay, you have a second?
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Okay, got a second by Gene. Any further discussion on the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, Tanner.
So a point of clarification, if you're going to add another unit on the Beaver and then you're going to decrease the tags, I don't see that working.
What did we decrease it?
Well, that was his amendment. Was what your recommendation was is he's taking some off of your recommendation.
The Beaver East, as my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first amendment was to make a subunit, which would be the Beaver West, that's separate than the Beaver East. So I think that what he is talking about, so Beaver West would be unlimited harvest objective. It's over here by itself, and Beaver East is going to be whatever it is, and it's going to go to 11, which I think is less than we recommended. But that is separate than the Beaver West.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. Okay, but Beaver West would be unlimited?
Yeah, if that passed, that's typically how we do preemptive bighorn sheep control.
Okay, so I hate to be snide and sarcastic, but I do appreciate what the houndsmen are doing, but it's also hilarious to me that you guys are thankful, or you're thanked by the sportsmen for being here and showing up, and so we need to, make allowances for you, because there doesn't seem to be very many allowances on the agricultural livestock side. So I agree with the subunit. I don't have a problem with that. Maybe that'll finally give Mineral Mountain livestock people a break on that one.
Okay.
Tammy, I just want to point out that it's the sportsman's rep that recommended giving livestock people on the mineral break.
Okay, let's vote on the amendment. This is for the amendment only. And the amendment, can you read it to us, Teresa?
So the amendment, I don't have the numbers in front of me, Riley, so the numbers that came out of your mouth was move the Beaver to 11, increase the Fillmore only by 2, so I'm not looking at the numbers, increase the Monroe only by 2.
No, that was the Pabant, wasn't it?
Fillmore and Pabant.
Oh, okay.
Fillmore, Pabant.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Monroe by 2.
Okay, sorry.
I wrote it down.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment? The one she just read to us. We're just talking about the increase or the reduction of tags. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment? Hold them up high. 3. All those opposed? Okay. 7. Motion fails. So now we're back to the main motion.
No, I have another amendment. I would like to make an amendment to the motion making the Buck Cliffs unit a split cougar unit.
We have a second? Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion, Wade?
Just a tiny bit. I just wanted to ask Darren, I get the reasoning behind this. I'm all for it. I hate out-of-staters. I guess that's what's popular. I don't know. But what would you see the difference in, this might be an impossible question, but what would the difference in harvest be likely?
It's a moving target, but so that unit's been harvest objective and then split and then harvest objective again. Back when it was harvest objective the first time, success was probably somewhere in the 65%. When it switched to split, it looked like the success rates were climbing, but they weren't hitting the total quota. Two out of the last 3 years, they've got 100%, and the year they didn't, I think they got 80. So it could be a function of a growing cougar population over that time. But what we would need to do if we go to a split is we may need to recommend more permits to make sure they're getting that. They've got deer concerns out there. They need to make sure they're taking a certain number of lions. And so we'd have to adjust permits based on where they needed to be management-wise. But other than that, it's purely social. It's just how you feel about non-residents and their opportunity.
Darren, could you explain that to me a little bit? I don't know why it's a
non-resident chart here somewhere. So I pulled this together. So this goes back to 2009. The green line are the number of lions killed by residents. And the red line is the number of lions killed by non-residents. That unit went from split into harvest objective in 2013. So they flip-flopped and they seem to be diverging. That's a social question. This is a perfect body to look at that and decide whether that is that something that, from a biological standpoint, I don't think it matters who kills them as long as we're taking the quota that needs to be taken. Does that help clarify things a little bit?
Thank you. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. All those in favor of the amendment?
You can go ahead and vote for something I did, Tammy. It's okay. It's a good idea. It's what residents
need.
Okay, hold them high. Hold them high.
Six.
All those opposed? Four. Okay. The amendment carries. Okay. Any further discussions on the main, on the motion?
Let me ask one more question, though. On your lines, on your non-residents, are they hiring these... your outfitters and stuff to come, or the local guys, or?
Yes, most guys that don't have their own dogs are hiring guides, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, Tammy, but the majority are guided out there, yeah.
Okay. All right, we're ready to vote on the motion, which as amended. And that is to accept as presented. We've included the Bookcliff split, and we've included the separation of the Beaver unit. Okay? All those in favor? All those opposed? Did anybody... That's okay. That's why we're here. You're doing your job. Okay. That concludes that item. I've lost my agenda. Do we need a break, or do we want to go to the last item and finish up? What's she doing? Okay. All right. We're going to go to number 8, which is the sensitive species rule amendment. Gentlemen, thanks for coming. Appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Okay. So Kim Hersey was supposed to present this. She is our non-game mammals coordinator. Her son is in the hospital. He's just has some metabolic problems. He'll be fine, but this is the first time that I have looked at this presentation. She talked me through a few things on the phone, so I think we're just going to go through it together the first time. So we've had the sensitive species rule, but there are some amendments. So the sensitive species rule, the goals are to reduce the likelihood of an Endangered Species Act listing, to guide management practices, to conserve the diversity of wildlife. And then it also identifies species in need of conservation attention in wildlife management, habitat restoration, reduction of impacts, and it also helps direct funding for certain species. So things that this rule is not, it's not regulatory. So it's not going to, sensitive species designations are not going to be used by governmental entities as a basis to involuntarily restrict the private property rights of landowners or lessees or their permittees. So which species? It's for native wildlife species or subspecies. Species that have substantial declines in population size or distribution, and species that we have cooperative management plans with, or if there's mitigation threats. Currently, we've got 19 mammals, 21 birds, 12 reptiles, 4 amphibians, 23 fishes, and 25 mollusks. I didn't even know we had that many. So the designation process, the DWR will submit recommendation backed by our data. We assess the potential impacts, and then DNR has a committee that meets and reviews. So that would include our executive director of DNR, PLPCO, our DWR staff, UDOGM, UWRE, so and any other department or division heads that are involved. And then any other interested people that can provide input. So like if we had an expert on pygmy rabbits. But the executive director, our Mike Styler, will bring that proposal to the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board will make final decisions on species that go on and off of the sensitive species list. So the proposed changes that she has in the rule, we're simplifying and just cleaning up the rule. The prior rule automatically added endangered species and conservation agreement species to it. This won't anymore. And then this also removes wildlife habitat designations because it was never used anyway. And we have had some conservation successes, you know, when we give attention to some of the species on our sensitive species list. So many have been petitioned for Endangered Species Act listing, but we found, you know, there's a list of species that were not found warranted. There were 3 new birds that were listed, but we also had 2 birds delisted, and there's 7 in progress for delisting or downlisting. So proactive conservation works. If you give some of these species some attention and work before, you know, let's keep them off the endangered species list. That's our goal. That's all she's got. And I really don't know a whole lot more about it. We could call Kim. Yeah.
I want to make one quick comment, can I?
Sure.
I do just think this is important to say, and this is why we're here. I think these are easily overlooked, and none of us really want to deal with it. But it's vitally important that the division's doing this, because what we don't want is federal managing these things, and the division is doing a fantastic job of being proactive, and I want to acknowledge that and say thank you.
Thank you, Bryn.
Comment or motion?
Wait. I'll second that.
Hey, easy.
You still got ways to go, Brian.
Can I jump in, Dave?
Wade.
My comment is basically the same as Braden's. I just, I do think it's super important. The worst thing that can happen to any of this is that ESA gets involved, and that hurts all of us. So I don't know a lot about this program, but it is important that we back it and make this thing work.
Right.
I noticed in there that she said that habitats will no longer be designated for these sensitive species. Is that right?
Yes, that what, where did she say that? When it's not. No. Yeah, it does. It removes wildlife habitat designations because in this list we never used it anyway.
Well, and it also gives ammunition to those that are petitioning.
Yes,
for
it does.
ESA is, yeah. So you got this area set aside, and why not make it official?
Mike, do you want to make a motion?
I'll move that we accept the recommendations as proposed.
Do you have a second? Any further discussion? All those in favor? Unanimous. There's no further business. We call the meeting adjourned. Thank you, everybody.